sounding more humble than Egwene would have believed she could. She was sprinkling water in jerky motions, sending up increasing clouds of steam. "I have been learning a great deal the past days, not having to spend time with him. Since you have allowed Egwene and Moiraine Sedai to help me with channeling, I learn even faster. Not that they teach any better than you, of course," she added hastily, "but I want very much to learn." "You will still learn," Milane told her. "You will not have to stay every hour with him. As long as you apply yourself, your lessons will not be much slowed. You do not study while you sleep."
"I cannot,"
Avienda mumbled, head down over the water gourd. More loudly and more firmly, she added, "I will not." Her head came up and her eyes were blue-green fire. "I will not be there when he summons that flip-skirt Isendra to his blankets again." Egwene gaped at her. Isendra? She had seen, and heartily disapproved of, the scandalous way the maidens kept the woman naked. But this... "You can't really mean he..." "Be silent," Bear snapped like a whip. Her blue-eyed stare could have chipped stone. "Both of you. You are both young, but even the maidens should know men can be fools, especially when they are not attached to a woman who can guide them." "I am glad," Amis said dryly, "to see you no longer hold your emotions so tightly, Avienda. Maidens are as foolish as men when it comes to that. I remember it well, and it embarrasses me still. Letting emotions go clouds judgment for a moment, but holding them in clouds it always. Just be sure you do not release them too often, or when it is best to keep control of them." Milane leaned forward on her hands until it seemed the sweat dripping from her face must fall on the hot kettle. "You know your fate, Avienda. You will be a wise one of great strength and great authority, and more besides. You already have a strength in you. It saw you through your first test, and it will see you through this."
"My honor,"
Avienda said hoarsely, then swallowed, unable to go on. She crouched there, huddling around the gourd as if it contained the honor she wanted to protect. "The pattern does not see Jito," Bear told her, with only a hint of sympathy, if that. "Only what must and will be. Men and maidens struggle against fate even when it is clear the pattern weaves on despite their struggles, but you are no longer Far Darai's Mai. You must learn to ride fate. Only by surrendering to the pattern can you begin to have some control over the course of your own life. If you fight, the pattern will still force you, and you will find only misery where you might have found contentment instead." To Egwene, that sounded very much like what she had been taught concerning the One Power. To control Sayidar, you first had to surrender to it. Fight, and it would come wildly or overwhelm you. Surrender, and guide it gently, and it did as you wished. But that did not explain why they wanted Avienda to do this thing. She asked as much, adding again, "It is not proper." Instead of answering, Amis said, "Will Randall Thor refuse to allow her? We cannot force him." Bear and Milane were looking at Egwene as intently as Amis. They were not going to tell her why. It was easier to make a stone talk than to get something out of a wise one against her will. Avienda was studying her toes in sulky resignation. She knew the wise ones would get what they wanted, one way or another. "I don't know," Egwene said slowly. "I do not know him as well as I used to." She regretted that, but so much had happened, quite aside from her realizing that she did not love him as more than a brother. Her training, in the tower as well as here, had changed things just as much as him being who he had become. "If you give him a good reason, perhaps. I think he likes Avienda." The young Aiel woman heaved a heavy sigh without looking up. "A good reason," Bear snorted. "When I was a girl, any man would have been overjoyed to have a young woman show that much interest in him. He would have gone to pick the flowers for her bridal wreath himself." Avienda started and glared at the wise ones with some of her old spirit. Well, we will find a reason even someone raised in the wetlands can accept. It is several nights before your agreed meeting in Tel Iran Riyadh, Amis said, with Nynaeve this time. That one could learn much, Bear put in, if she were not so stubborn. Your nights are free until then, Milane said. That is, unless you have been entering Tel Iran Riyadh without us. Egwene suspected what was coming. Of course not, she told them. It had only been a little. Any more than a little, and they would find out for sure. Have you succeeded in finding either Nynaeve's or Elaine's dreams? Amis asked, casually, as if it were nothing. No, Amis. Finding someone else's dreams was a lot harder than stepping into Tel Iran Riyadh, the world of dreams, especially if they were any distance away. It was easier both the closer they were and the better you knew them. The wise ones still demanded that she not enter Tel Iran Riyadh without at least one of them along, but someone else's dream was maybe just as dangerous in its own way. In Tel Iran Riyadh, she was in control of herself and of things around her to a large degree, unless one of the wise ones decided to take over. Her command of Tel Iran Riyadh was increasing, but she still could not match any of them with their long experience. In another's dream, though, you were a part of that dream. It took all you could muster not to behave as the dreamer wanted, be as their dream took you, and still sometimes it did not work. The wise ones had been very careful when watching Rand's dreams never to enter fully. Even so, they insisted she learn. If they were to teach dreamwalking, they meant to teach all that they knew of it. She was not reluctant exactly, but the few times they had let her practice, with themselves and once with Ruark, had been chastening experiences. The wise ones had some considerable mastery over their own dreams, so what had happened there, to show her the dangers, they said, had all been their doing, but it had been a shock to learn that Ruark saw her as a little more than a child, like his youngest daughters. And her own control had wavered for one fatal moment. After that, she had been little more than a child. She still could not look at the man without remembering being given a doll for studying hard, and being as pleased with the gift as with his approval. Amis had had to come and take her away from happy play with it. Amis knowing was bad enough, but she suspected that Ruark remembered some of it too. You must keep trying, Amis said. You have the strength to reach them even as far as they are, and it will do you no harm to learn how they see you. She was not so sure of that herself. Elaine was a friend, but Nynaeve had been wisdom of Emmon's Field for most of her growing up. She suspected Nynaeve's dreams would be worse than Ruark's. Tonight I will sleep away from the tents, Amis went on. Not far. You should be able to find me easily, if you try. If I do not dream of you, we will speak of it in the morning. Egwene suppressed a groan. Amis had guided her to Ruark's dreams. She herself had remained only an instant, barely long enough to reveal that Ruark still saw her, unchanged, as the young woman he had married, and the wise ones had always been in the same tent before when she tried. Well, Bear said, rubbing her hands. We have heard what needed to be heard. The rest of you can remain if you wish, but I feel clean enough to go to my blankets. I am not so young as the rest of you. Young or not, she could probably run any of them into the ground, then carry them the rest of the way. As Bear was getting to her feet, Milane spoke, and strangely for her, she was hesitant. I must ask for your help, Bear. And you, Amis. The older woman settled back, and both she and Amis looked at Milane expectantly. I would ask you to approach Dorinda for me. The last words came out in a rush. Amis smiled widely, and Bear cackled aloud. Avienda seemed to understand, too, and be startled, but Egwene was lost. Then Bear laughed. You always said you did not need a husband and did not want one. I have buried three and would not mind another. They are very useful when the night is cold. A woman can change her mind. Milane's voice was firm enough, but belied by the deep flush in her cheeks. I cannot stay away from Bael, and I cannot kill him. If Dorinda will accept me as her sister-wife, I will make my bridal wreath to lay at Bael's feet.
What if he steps on it instead of picking it up? Bear wanted to know.
Amice fell back, laughing and slapping her thighs. Egwene did not think there was much danger of that, not the way Aiel customs ran. If Dorinda decided she wanted Melaine for sister-wife, Bael would not have much say in the matter. It no longer shocked her, precisely, that a man could have two wives. Not exactly. Different lands mean different customs, she reminded herself firmly. She had never been able to bring herself to ask, but for all she knew, there might be Aiel women with two husbands. They were very strange people. I ask you to act as my first sisters in this. I think that Dorinda likes me well enough. As soon as Melaine spoke those words, the other women's hilarity changed to something else. They still laughed, but they hugged her and told her how happy they were for her, and how well she would do with Bael. Amis and Bear, at least, took Dorinda's acceptance for granted. The three of them departed all but arm in arm, still laughing and giggling like girls. Not before telling Egwene and Avienda to straighten the tent, though.
Egwene, could a woman of your land accept a sister-wife?
Avienda asked, using a stick to push the cover off the smoke hole. Egwene wished she had left that duty till last. The heat began to dissipate immediately.
I don't know, she said, quickly gathering the cups and the honey jar. The styra went onto the tray, too. I don't think so. Maybe if it was a close friend, she added hurriedly. There was no point in seeming to denigrate Aiel ways.
Avienda only grunted and began pushing up the side flaps, teeth chattering as loudly as the rattle of teacups and bronze blades on the tray. Egwene scurried outside. The wise ones were dressing unhurriedly, as though this were a balmy night and they in sleeping chambers in some hold. A white-robed figure, pale in the moonlight, took the tray from her, and she quickly began searching for her cloak and shoes. They were nowhere among the remaining garments on the ground.
"I had your things taken to your tent," Bear said, tying the laces of her blouse. "You will not need them yet."
Egwene's stomach sank into her feet. Hopping in place, she flapped her arms in a futile effort for warmth. At least they did not tell her to stop. Abruptly, she realized the snowy-robed figure bearing the tray away was too tall for even an Aiel woman. Gritting her teeth, she glared at the wise ones, who seemed not to care if she froze to death jumping up and down. To the Aiel women it might not matter that a man had seen them with no clothes on, at least if he was a Gaishine, but it did to her. In a moment Avienda joined them, and seeing her leaping about, merely stood there without any effort to find her own garments. She showed no more effect of the cold than the wise ones.
Now, Bear said, settling her shawl on her shoulders. You, Avienda, are not only stubborn as a man, you cannot remember a simple task you have done many times. You, Egwene, are just as stubborn, and you still think you can linger in your tent when you are summoned. Let us hope running 50 times around the camp will temper your stubbornness, clear your minds, and remind you of how to answer a summons or do a chore. Off with you.
Without a word, Avienda immediately began loping toward the edge of the camp, easily dodging dark-shrouded tent ropes. Egwene hesitated only a moment before following. The Aiel woman kept her pace down so she could catch up. The night air froze her, and the cracked stony clay underfoot was just as cold, and tried to catch her toes besides. Avienda ran with effortless ease. As they reached the last tent and turned southward, Avienda said,
"Do you know why I study so hard?"
Neither the cold nor running had made an impression on her voice. Egwene was shivering so hard she could barely speak.
"No. Why?"
"Because Bear and the others always point to you and tell me how easily you learn, how you never have to have something explained twice. They say I ought to be more like you." She gave Egwene a sidelong glance, and Egwene found herself sharing a giggle as they ran.
"That is part of the reason. The things I am learning to do..."
Avienda shook her head, wonderment plain even by moonlight.
"And the power itself. I've never felt like that, so alive. I can smell the faintest scent, feel the slightest stir in the air.
It is dangerous to hold on too long or too much, Egwene said. Running did seem to warm her a little, though now and again a shudder ran through her.
I've told you that, and I know the wise ones have too.
Avienda merely sniffed.
Do you think I would stab my own foot with a spear?
For a time they ran in silence.
Did Rand really...
Egwene said finally. The cold had nothing to do with her difficulty getting the words out. In fact, she was beginning to sweat again.
I mean... Isendra?
She could not make herself say it clearer than that. At last Avienda said slowly,
I do not think that he did.
She sounded angry. But why would she ignore switchings if he has shown no interest in her? She is a milk-hearted wetlander who waits for men to come to her. I saw how he looked at her, though he tried to hide it. He enjoyed looking at her. Egwene wondered if her friend ever thought of her as a milk-hearted wetlander. Probably not, or they would not be friends. But Avienda had never learned to worry if what she said might hurt someone. She would probably be surprised to learn that Egwene could even think of being hurt.
The way the maidens make her dress, Egwene admitted reluctantly, any man would look.
Reminded that she herself was in the open without any clothes, she stumbled and almost fell as she looked around anxiously. The night was empty as far as she could make out. Even the wise ones were already back in their tents, warm in their blankets. She was sweating, but the beads seemed to want to freeze as soon as they appeared.
He belongs to Elaine, Avienda said fiercely.
I admit I don't know your customs fully, but ours are not the same as yours. He is not betrothed to Elaine.
Why am I defending him? He's the one who ought to be switched.
But honesty made her go on.
Even your Aiel men have the right to say no if they're asked.
You and she are near sisters, as you and I are, Avienda protested, slowing a step before picking it up again. Did you not ask me to look after him for her? Do you not want her to have him?
Of course I do.
If he wants her?
That was not exactly true.
She wanted Elaine to have what happiness she could, in love with the dragon reborn as she was, and she would do everything short of tying Rand hand and foot to see that Elaine got what she wanted. Maybe not far short at that, if need be. Admitting it was another thing. Aiel women were far more forward than she could ever make herself be.
It would not be right otherwise.
He belongs to her, Avienda said determinedly. Egwene sighed. Avienda simply did not want to understand any customs but her own. The Aiel woman was still shocked that Elaine would not ask Rand to marry her, that a man could ask that question.
I'm sure the wise ones will listen to reason tomorrow. They can't make you sleep in a man's bedchamber.
The other woman looked at her in clear surprise. For a moment her grace left her, and she stubbed a toe on the uneven ground. The mishap brought a few curses that would have made even Kader's wagon drivers listen with interest, and made Bear reach for the blue spine. But she did not stop running.
I do not understand why that upsets you so, she said, when the last curse died. I have slept next to a man many times on raids, even sharing blankets for warmth if the night was very cold, but it disturbs you that I will sleep within 10 feet of him. Is this part of your customs?
I have noticed you will not bathe in the sweat tent with men.
Do you not trust Randalthor?
Or is it me you do not trust?
Her voice had sunk to a concerned whisper by the end.
Of course I trust you, Egwene protested heatedly. And him. It's just that...
She trailed off, uncertain how to go on.
Aiel notions of propriety were sometimes stricter than what she had grown up with, but in other ways they would have had the women circle back home trying to decide whether to faint or reach for a stout stick.
Avienda, if your honor is involved somehow...
This was touchy ground.
Surely, if you explain to the wise ones, they will not make you go against your honor.
There is nothing to explain, the other woman said flatly.
I know I don't understand Ji'ito, Egwene began, and Avienda laughed.
You say you do not understand it, Aes Sedai, yet you show that you live by it. Egwene regretted maintaining that lie with her. It had been hard work to get Avienda to call her simply Egwene, and sometimes she slipped back, but it had to be kept with everyone if it was to hold with anyone. You are Aes Sedai, and strong enough in the power to overcome Amis and Melaine together, Avienda continued. But you said that you would obey, so you scrub pots when they say scrub pots, and you run when they say run. You may not know Jito, but you follow it. It was not the same thing at all, of course. She gritted her teeth and did as she was told, because that was the only way to learn dreamwalking, and she wanted to learn everything, more than anything else she could imagine. To even think that she could live by this foolish Jito was simply silly. She did what she had to do, and only when and because she had to. They were coming back to where they had begun. As her foot hit the spot, Egwene said, "That's one," and ran on through the darkness with no one to see but Avienda, no one to say whether she went back to her tent right then. Avienda would not have told, but it never occurred to Egwene to stop short of the 50.
Chapter 6 Gateways. Rand woke in total darkness and lay there beneath his blankets trying to think of what had wakened him. It had been something. Not the dream. He had been teaching Avienda how to swim, in a pond in the Waterwood, back home in the Two Rivers. Something else. Then it came again, like a faint whiff of a foul miasma creeping under the floor. Not a smell at all, really. A sense of otherness. But that was how it felt. Rank, like something dead a week in stagnant water. It faded again, but not all the way this time. Tossing aside his blankets, he stood up, wrapping himself in Sidene. Inside the void, filled with the power, he could feel his body shiver, but the cold seemed in another place from where he was. Cautiously, he pulled open the door and stepped out. Arched windows at either end of the corridor let in falls of moonlight. After the pitch black of his room, it was nearly like day. Nothing moved, but he could feel something coming closer, something evil. It felt like the taint that roared through him on the power. One hand went to his coat pocket to the small carved figure of a round little man holding a sword across his knees. An Angrial. With that, he could channel more of the power than even he could safely handle unaided. He thought it would not be necessary. Whoever had sent this attack against him did not know who they were dealing with now. They should never have let him wake. For a moment, he hesitated. He could take the fight to whatever had been sent against him, but he thought it was still below him, down where the maidens were still sleeping by the silence. With luck, it would not bother them, unless he rushed down to battle it in their midst. That would surely wake them, and they would not stand by and watch. Lan said that you should choose your ground if you could, and make your enemy come to you. Smiling, he raced the thud of his boots up the nearest curving stairway, on upward until he reached the top floor. The highest level of the building was one large chamber, with a slightly domed ceiling and scattered thin columns fluted in spirals. Glassless, arched windows all around flooded every corner with moonlight. The dust and grit and sand on the floor still faintly showed his own footprints from the one time he had come up here, and no other mark. It was perfect. Striding to the center of the room, he planted himself atop the mosaic there, the ancient symbol of the Aes Sedai, 10 feet across. It was an apt place. Under this sign will he conquer. That was what the prophecy of Rudion said of him. He stood straddling the sinuous dividing line, one boot on the black teardrop that was now called the Dragon's Fang, and used to represent evil, the other on the white, now called the Flame of Tarvalin. Some men said it stood for the light. An appropriate place to meet this attack, between light and darkness. The fetid feel grew stronger, and a burned sulfur smell filled the air. Suddenly things moved, slinking away from the stairs like moon shadows, along the outside of the room. Slowly they resolved into three black dogs, darker than night and big as ponies. Eyes shining silver, they circled him warily. With the power in him, he could hear their hearts beat, like deep drums pounding. He could not hear them breathe, though. Perhaps they did not. He channeled, and a sword was in his hands, its slightly curving heron-marked blade seeming hammered out of fire. He had expected Murdral, or something even worse than the Eyeless, but for dogs, even Shadowspawn dogs, the sword would be enough. Whoever had sent them did not know him. Lan said he had very nearly reached the level of a blade master now, and the warder was sparing enough with praise to make him think he might have passed on to that level already. With snarls like bones being ground to dust, the dogs hurtled at him from three sides, faster than galloping horses. He did not move until they were almost on him. Then he flowed, one with the sword, move to move, as though dancing. In the blink of an eye, the sword form called Whirlwind on the Mountain became the Wind Blows Over the Wall, became Unfolding the Fan. Great black heads flew apart from black bodies, their dripping teeth like burnished steel, still bared as they bounced across the floor. He was already stepping from the mosaic as the dark forms collapsed in twitching, bleeding heaps. Laughing to himself, he let the sword go, though he held on to Saidin, to the raging power, the sweetness, and the taint. Contempt slid along the outside of the void. Dogs. Shadowspawn, certainly, but still just... Laughter died. Slowly, the dead dogs and their heads were melting, settling into pools of liquid shadow that quivered slightly, as if alive. Their blood, fanned across the floor, trembled. Suddenly, the smaller pools flowed across the floor in viscous streams to merge with the larger, which oozed away from the mosaic to mount higher and higher, until the three huge black dogs stood there once more, slavering and snarling as they gathered massive haunches under them. He did not know why he felt surprise, dim outside the emptiness. Dogs, yes, but shadow spawn. Whoever had sent them had not been as careless as he had thought, but they still did not know him. Instead of reaching for the sword again, he channeled as he remembered doing once long ago. Howling, the huge dogs leaped, and a thick shaft of white light shot from his hands like molten steel, like liquid fire. He swept it across the springing creatures. For an instant, they became shadows of themselves, all colors reversed, and then they were made of sparkling motes that broke apart, smaller and smaller, until there was nothing. He let go of the thing he had made with a grim smile. A purple bar of light still seemed to cross his vision in afterimage. Across the great chamber, a piece of one of the columns crashed to the floor tiles. Where that bar of light, or whatever it had been, not light exactly, had swung, neat slices were gone from the columns. A gaping swath cut half the width of the wall behind them.
"Did any of them bite you or bleed on you?"
He spun at the sound of Moraine's voice. Absorbed in what he had done, he had not heard her come up the stairs. She stood clutching her skirts with both hands, peering at him, face lost in moonshadow. She would have sensed the things the same way he did, but to be here so quickly, she must have run. "The maidens let you pass? Have you become Fardarai's Mai, Moraine?"
"They grant me some privileges of a wise one," she said in a rush, impatience raw in her usually melodious voice. "I told the guards I had to speak with you urgently. Now answer me! Did the Dark Hounds bite you or bleed on you? Did their saliva touch you?"
"No," he answered slowly. Dark Hounds. The little he knew he had gotten from old stories, the sort used to frighten children in the Southlands. Some grown-ups believed, too. "Why should a bite worry you? You could heal it. Does this mean the Dark One is free?" Enclosed in the void as he was, even fear was distant. The tales he had heard said the Dark Hounds ran the night in the Wild Hunt, with the Dark One himself the hunter. They left no print on even the softest dirt, only on stone, and they would not stop until you faced and defeated them, or put running water between you. Crossroads were supposed to be particularly dangerous places to meet them, and the time just after sunset or just before sunrise. He had seen enough old stories walking by now to believe that any of it could be true.
No, not that, Rand.
She seemed to be regaining her self-control. Her voice was silver chimes again, calm and cool. They are only another kind of shadow spawn, something that should never have been made. But their bite is death as surely as a dagger in the heart, and I do not think I could have healed such a wound before it killed you. Their blood, even their saliva, is poison. A drop on the skin can kill, slowly, with great pain at the end. You are lucky there were only three, unless you killed more before I arrived. Their packs are usually larger, as many as 10 or 12, or so say the scraps left from the War of the Shadow. Larger packs. He was not the only target in Roydian for one of the Forsaken. We must speak of what you used to kill them, Moraine began, but he was already running as hard as he could, ignoring her cries to know where he was going and why. Down flights of stairs, through darkened corridors, where sleepy maidens roused by the pounding boots peered at him in consternation from moonlit rooms. Through the front doors, where Lan stood restlessly, with the two women on guard, his color-shifting warder's cloak about his shoulders, making parts of him seem to blend into the night. "Where is Moraine?" he shouted, as Rand dashed by. But Rand leaped down the broad steps two at a time without replying. The half-healed wound in his side clenched like a fist, pain he was only vaguely aware of inside the void, by the time he reached the building he sought. It stood at the very edge of Rydion, far from the plaza, as far from the camp Moraine shared with the Wise Ones as it was possible to be and remain in the city. The upper floors had collapsed in a mound of rubble that fanned out onto the cracked earth beyond the pavement. Only the bottom two floors remained whole. Refusing his body's efforts to hunch over around the pane, he went in, still at a dead run. Once the great antechamber, encircled by a stone balcony, had been tall. Now it was taller, open to the night sky, its pale stone floor strewn with rubble from the collapse. In the moon shadows beneath the balcony, three dark hounds were up on their hind legs, clawing and chewing at a bronze-clad door that shivered under their assault. The smell of burned sulfur hung strong in the air. Remembering what had happened before, Rand darted to one side as he channeled, the shaft of liquid white light streaking by the door as it destroyed the shadow spawn. He had tried to make it less this time to confine the destruction to the dark hounds, but the thick wall at the far end of the chamber had a shadowed hole in it. Not all the way through, he thought, it was hard to tell by moonlight, but he would have to refine his control of this weapon. The bronze sheathing on the door was tattered and torn as though the teeth and toenails of the dark hounds really had been steel. Lamplight shone through a number of small holes. There were paw prints in the floorstones, but surprisingly few. Releasing Saidin, he found a place where he would not cut his hand to shreds and pounded on the door. Suddenly the pain in his side was very real and present. He took a deep breath and tried to thrust it away.
"Matt! It's me, Rand! Open up, Matt!"
After a moment, the door opened a crack, letting out a spill of lamplight. Matt peered through doubtfully, then pulled the door wider, leaning against it as if he had run 10 miles carrying a sack of rocks. Except for a silver foxhead medallion hanging around his neck, its eye shaped and shaded like the ancient Aes Sedai symbol, he was naked. The way Matt felt about Aes Sedai, Rand was surprised he had not sold the thing long since. Deeper in the room, a tall, golden-haired woman was calmly wrapping a blanket around herself. A maiden, by the spears and buckler lying at her feet. Rand hastily averted his eyes and cleared his throat.
"I just wanted to make sure you were all right."
"We're fine.
Uneasily, Matt looked around the antechamber. Now we are. You killed it or something? I don't want to know what it was as long as it's gone. It's bloody hard on a man sometimes being your friend. Not only a friend, another Taviran, and perhaps a key to victory in Tarmageddon. Anyone who wanted to strike at Rand had reason to strike at Matt as well. But Matt always tried to deny both things. They're gone, Matt. Darkhounds, three of them. I told you I didn't want to know, Matt groaned. Darkhounds now. I can't say it isn't always something new around you. A man wouldn't get bored, not until the day he died. If I hadn't been on my feet for a drink of wine when the door started to open... He trailed off, shivering, and scratched a red place on his right arm as he studied the ravaged metal sheathing. You know, it's funny how the mind plays tricks. When I was putting everything I had into holding this door shut, I could have sworn one of them had chewed a hole right through it. I could see its bloody head. And its teeth. Melindra's spear didn't even faze it. Moraine's arrival was more spectacular this time. Running in, skirts held up, panting and fuming. Lan was at her heels with his sword in hand and thunderclouds on his stone face, and right behind, a throng of Fardarai's Mai that spilled out into the street. Some of the maidens wore no more than small clothes, but everyone held her spears alertly and had her shufa wrapped around her head, black veil hiding all but her eyes, ready to kill. Moraine and Lan, at least, looked relieved to see him standing there calmly talking to Matt, though the Aes Sedai also looked as if she meant to have strong words with him. With the veils, it was impossible to tell what the Aiel thought. Letting out a loud yelp, Matt darted back into his room and began hastily tugging on a pair of breeches, his capering impeded by the way he kept trying to haul at the breeches and scratch his arm at the same time. The golden-haired maiden watched with a broad grin that threatened to break into laughter. "What's the matter with your arm?" Rand asked. "I told you the mind plays funny tricks," Matt said, still trying to scratch and pull at the same time. "When I thought that thing chewed through the door, I thought it slobbered all over my arm, too. And now it bloody itches like fire. Even looks like a burn there." Rand opened his mouth, but Moraine was already pushing past him. Staring at her, Matt fell down while frantically dragging his breeches on the rest of the way. But she knelt beside him, ignoring his protests, clasping his head in her hands. Rand had been healed before and seen it done. But instead of what he expected, Matt only gave a shiver and lifted up the medallion by its leather thong so that it hung against his hand. "Bloody thing is colder than ice all of a sudden," he muttered. "What are you doing, Moraine? If you want to do something, heal this itch. It has my whole arm now." His right arm was red from wrist to shoulder and had begun to look puffy. Moraine stared at him with the most startled expression Rand had ever seen on her face. Maybe the only one. "I will," she said slowly. "If the medallion is cold, take it off." Matt frowned at her, then finally pulled it over his head and laid it beside him. She took his head again, and he gave a shout as if he had been ducked, head first, into ice. His legs stiffened, and his back arched. His eyes stared at nothing, as wide as they would go. When Moraine took her hands away, he slumped, gulping air. The redness and swelling were gone. It took three tries before he could speak.
"Blood and ashes! Does it have to be that flaming way every flaming time? It was just a bloody itch."
"You watch your tongue with me," Moraine told him, getting up, "or I will find Nynaeve and put her in charge of you."
But her heart was not in it. She could have been talking in her sleep. She was trying not to stare at the fox head as Matt hung it back around his neck.
"You will need rest," she said absently. "Stay in bed tomorrow if you feel like it."
The maiden in the blanket, Melindra, knelt behind Matt and put her hands on his shoulders, looking up at Moraine over his head.
"I will see that he does as you say, Aes Sedai."
With a sudden grin, she ruffled his hair.
"He is my little mischief-maker now."
From the horrified look on Matt's face, he was gathering his strength to run. Rand became aware of soft, amused chuckles behind him. The maidens, shufas and veils around their shoulders now, had crowded around and were peering into the room.
"Teach him to sing, spear sister," Adeline said,
and the other maidens crowed with laughter. Rand rounded on them firmly. "Let the man rest. Don't some of you have to put on clothes?" They gave way reluctantly, still trying to peer into the room, until Moraine came out.
"Will you leave us, please?"
the Aes Sedai said, as the mangled door banged shut behind her. She half looked back with a vexed tightening of her mouth.
"I must speak with Randall Thor alone."
Nodding, the Aiel women started for the door, some still jesting about whether Melindra, a Shido, it seemed, Rand wondered if Matt knew that, would teach Matt to sing. Whatever that meant. Rand stopped Adeline with a hand on her bare arm. Others who noticed stopped as well, so he spoke to them all.
"If you will not go when I tell you to, what will you do if I have to use you in battle?"
He did not intend to if he could help it. He knew they were fierce warriors, but he had been raised to believe it was a man's place to die if necessary before a woman had to. Logic might say it was foolish, especially with women like this, but that was how he felt. He knew better than to tell them that, however. "Will you think it is a joke, or decide to go in your own good time?"
They looked at him with the consternation of those listening to someone who had revealed his ignorance of the simplest facts. "In the Dance of Spears," Adeline told him, "we will go as you direct. But this is not the dance. Besides, you did not tell us to go."
"Even the Kaar Karn is not a wetlander king," a gray-haired maiden added.
Sinewy and hard despite her age, she wore only a short shift and her shufa. He was tired of getting that phrase. The maidens resumed their joking as they left him alone with Moraine and Lan. The warder had finally put up his sword and looked as at ease as he ever did. Which was to say, as still and calm as his face, all stony planes and angles in the moonlight, and with an air of being on the brink of sudden movement that made the Aiel appear placid in comparison. A braided leather cord held Lan's hair, graying at the temples, back from his face. His gaze could have come from a blue-eyed hawk.
"I must speak with you about—" Moraine began.
"We can talk tomorrow," Rand said, cutting her off. Lan's face hardened further, if such was possible. Warders were far more protective of their Aes Sedai, of their position, as well as their persons, than they were of themselves. Rand ignored Lan. His side still wanted to hunch him over, but he managed to keep erect. He was not about to show her any weakness.
"If you think I'll help you get that fox head away from Matt, you can think again."
Somehow that medallion had stopped her channeling, or at least it had stopped her channeling from affecting Matt while he touched it. "He paid a hard price for it, Maureen, and it is his." Thinking of how she had thumped his shoulders with the power, he added dryly, "Maybe I'll ask if I can borrow it from him." He turned away from her. There was still one he had to check on, though one way or another the urgency was gone. The Darkhounds would have done what they intended by now.
"Please, Rand,"
Moraine said, and the open pleading in her voice halted him in his tracks. He had never heard anything like that from her before. The tone seemed to offend Lan.
"I thought you had become a man," the warder said harshly. "Is this how a man behaves? You act like an arrogant boy."
Lan practiced the sword with him, and liked him, Rand thought. But if Moraine said the right word, the warder would do his best to kill him.
"I will not be with you forever," Moraine said urgently.
Her hands gripped her skirts so hard that they trembled.
"I might die in the next attack. I could fall from my horse and break my neck, or take a dark friend's arrow through my heart. And death cannot be healed. I have given my entire life to the search for you, to find you and help you. You still do not know your own strength, and you cannot know half of what you do. I apologize most humbly for any offense I have given you."
Those words, words he had never thought to hear from her, came out as if dragged, but they came, and she could not lie. "Let me help you as much as I can, while I can. Please." "It's hard to trust you, Moraine." He disregarded Lan, shifting in the moonlight. His attention was all on her. "You have handled me like a puppet, made me dance the way you wanted from the day we met. The only times I've been free of you were either when you were far away or when I ignored you. And you make even that hard." Her laugh was as silvery as the moon above, but bitterness tinged it. "It has been more like wrestling with a bear than pulling strings on a puppet. Do you want an oath not to try manipulating you? I give it." Her voice hardened to crystal. "I swear to obey you, like one of the maidens. Like one of the guys shine, if you require. But you must..." Taking a deep breath, she began again, more softly. "I ask you, humbly, to allow me to help you." Lan was staring at her, and Rand thought his own eyes must be popping out of his head. "I will accept your help," he said slowly. "And I apologize, too, for all the rudeness I've shown." He had the feeling he was still being manipulated. He had had good cause to be rude when he was, but she could not lie. Tension drained from her visibly. She stepped closer to look up at him. "What you use to kill the Dark Hounds is called Bale Fire. I can still sense the residue of it here." He could, too, like the fading smell remaining after a pie was carried out of the room, or the memory of something just snatched out of sight. "Since before the breaking of the world, the use of Bale Fire has been forbidden. The White Tower forbids us even to learn it. In the War of Power, the Forsaken and the Shadow Sworn themselves used it only reluctantly." "Forbidden," Rand said, frowning. "I saw you use it once." He could not be sure in the pale light of the moon, but he thought color flamed in her cheeks. For this once, perhaps she was the one off balance. "Sometimes it is necessary to do that which is forbidden." If she was flustered, it did not show in her voice. "When anything is destroyed with balefire, it ceases to exist before the moment of its destruction, like a thread that burns away from where the flame touched it. The greater the power of the balefire, the further back in time it ceases to exist. The strongest I can manage will remove only a few seconds from the pattern. You are much stronger. Very much so. But if it doesn't exist before you destroy it..." Rand raked fingers through his hair in confusion. "You begin to see the problems, the dangers. Matt remembers seeing one of the Dark Hounds chew through the door, but there is no opening now. If it had slavered on him as much as he remembers, he would have been dead before I could reach him. For as far back as you destroyed the creature, whatever it did during that time, no longer happened. Only the memories remain, for those who saw or experienced it. Only what it did before is real, now. A few tooth holes in the door and one drop of saliva on Matt's arm." "That sounds just fine to me," he told her. "Matt's alive because of it." "It is terrible, Rand." An urgent note entered her voice. "Why do you think even the Forsaken feared to use it? Think of the effect on the pattern of a single thread, one man, removed from hours or days that have already been woven, like one thread picked partly out of a piece of cloth. Fragments of manuscripts remaining from the War of Power say several entire cities were destroyed with balefire before both sides realized the dangers. Hundreds of thousands of threads pulled from the pattern, gone for days already past. Whatever those people had done, now no longer had been done, and neither had what others had done because of their actions. The memories remained, but not the actions. The ripples were incalculable. The pattern itself nearly unraveled. It could have been the destruction of everything. World, time, creation itself. Rand shivered, nothing to do with the cold cutting through his coat.
I can't promise not to use it again, Moraine. You yourself said there are times when it's necessary to do what's forbidden.
I did not think that you would, she said coolly. Her agitation was vanishing, her balance restored.
But you must be careful.
She was back to must again.
With a Sangreal, like Kalendor, you could annihilate a city with balefire. The pattern could be disrupted for years to come. Who can say that the weave would even remain centered on you, Tavirin as you are, until it settled down? Being Tavirin, and so strongly so, may be your margin of victory, even in the last battle.
Perhaps it will, he said bleakly. In tale after heroic tale, the protagonist proclaimed he would have victory or death. It seemed that the best he could hope for was victory and death.
I have to check on someone, he went on quietly. I will see you in the morning.
Gathering the power into him, life and death in swirling layers, he made a hole in the air taller than he was, opening into blackness that made the moonlight seem day. A gateway, Asmodian called it.
What is that?
Moraine gasped. Once I've done something, I remember how. Most of the time. That was no answer, but it was time to test Moraine's vows. She could not lie, but Aes Sedai could find loopholes in a stone. You are to leave Matt alone tonight, and you won't try to take that medallion away from him.
It belongs in the tower for study, Rand. It must be a Tirangreal, but none has ever been found that...
Whatever it is, he said firmly, it is his. You will leave it with him. For a moment she seemed to struggle with herself, back stiffening and head coming up as she stared at him. She could not be used to taking orders from anyone except Swan Sanchez, and Rand was willing to wager she had never done that without a tussle. Finally she nodded, and even made the suggestion of a curtsy.
As you say, Rand, it is his. Please be careful, Rand. Learning a thing like balefire by yourself can be suicide, and death cannot be healed.
This time there was no mockery.
Until the morning.
Lan followed her as she left, the warder giving Rand an unreadable expression. He would not be pleased by this turn of events. Rand stepped through the gateway, and it vanished. He was standing on a disk, a 6-foot copy of the ancient Aes Sedai symbol. Even the black half of it seemed lighter against the endless darkness that surrounded him, above and below. He was sure that if he fell off, he would fall forever. Asmodian claimed there was a faster method called traveling for using a gateway, but he had not been able to teach it, partly because he did not have the strength to make a gateway while wearing Lanfear's shield. In any case, traveling required that you know your starting point very well. It seemed more logical to him that you should have to know where you were heading well, but Asmodian seemed to think that that was like asking why air was not water. There was a great deal that Asmodian took for granted. Anyway, skimming was fast enough. As soon as he planted his boots on it, the disk lurched what seemed to be a foot and stopped, another gateway appearing in front of it. Fast enough, especially over this short distance. Rand stepped into the hallway outside the room where Asmodian was. The moon through the windows at the ends of the corridor gave the only light. Asmodian's lamp was out. The flows he had woven around the room were still in place, still firmly tied. Nothing moved, but there was still a faint smell of burned sulfur. Moving close to the bead curtain, he peered through the doorway. Moon shadows filled the room, but one of them was Asmodian, tossing in his blankets. Wrapped in the void, Rand could hear his heartbeat, smell the sweat of troubled dreams. He bent to examine the pale blue floor tiles, and the prints impressed in them. He had learned to track as a boy, and reading them was no difficulty. 3 or 4 Darkhounds had been there. They had approached the doorway one by one, it seemed, each stepping almost in the other's footprints. Had the net woven around the room stopped them there? or had they merely been sent to look and report? Troubling to think of even Shadowspawn dogs having that much intelligence. But then Murdral used ravens and rats for spies, too, and other animals closely linked to death. Shadow Eyes, the Aiel called them. Channeling fine flows of earth, he smoothed out the floor tiles, lifting up the compressions until he was out in the empty, night-cloaked street and 100 paces from the tall building. In the morning, anyone would be able to see the trail ending there, but none would suspect that the Darkhounds had gone anywhere near Osmodian. Darkhounds could have no interest in Jason Attail the Gleeman. Every maiden in the city was likely awake by this time. Certainly none would still be asleep under the roof of the maidens. Making another gateway, there in the street, a deeper blackness against the night, he let the disk carry him back to his own room. He wondered why he had chosen the ancient symbol. It was his choice, if unconscious. Other times it had been a stair-step or a piece of floor. The Darkhounds had oozed away from that sign before reforming. Under this sign will he conquer. Standing in his pitch-black bedchamber, he channeled the lamps alight, but he did not let go of Sidene. Instead, he channeled again, careful not to spring any of his own traps, and a piece of wall vanished, revealing a niche he had carved there himself. In the little alcove stood 2 figurines, 1 foot tall, a man and a woman, each in flowing robes and serene of face, each holding a crystal globe aloft in one hand. He had lied to Osmodian about them. There were Angreal, like the round little man in Rand's coat pocket, and Sa-Angreal, like Kalendor, that increased the amount of the power that could be safely handled as much over Angreal as Angreal did over channeling unaided. Both were very rare and prized by Aes Sedai, though they could only recognize those attuned to women and Sidar. These 2 figures were something else, not so rare, but just as highly valued. Tirangriel had been made to use the power, not magnify it, but to use it in specific ways. The Aes Sedai did not know the intended purpose even of most Tirangriel they had in the White Tower. Some they used, but without knowing whether the use they put them to was anything like the function they had been made for. Rand knew the function of these 2. The male figure could link him to a huge replica of itself, the most powerful male Sa-Angreal ever made, even if he were on the other side of the Arath Ocean from it. It had only been finished after the Dark One's prison was resealed. How do I know that? And hidden before any of the male Aes Sedai going mad could find it. The female figure could do the same for a woman, joining her to the female equivalent of the great statue he hoped was still almost completely buried in Carrion. With that much power, Moraine had said death could not be healed. Unbidden, unwanted, memory returned of the next to last time he had dared let himself hold Kalendor, images floating beyond the void. The body of the dark-haired girl, little more than a child, lay sprawled with eyes wide and fixed on the ceiling, blood blackening the bosom of her dress where a trollic had run her through. The power was in him. Kalendor blazed, and he was the power. He channeled, directing flows into the child's body, searching, trying, fumbling. She lurched to her feet, arms and legs unnaturally rigid and jerky.
"Rand, you cannot do this!" Moraine cried. "Not this!"
Breathe. She had to breathe. The girl's chest rose and fell. Heart had to beat. Blood already thick and dark oozed from the wound in her chest.
"Live, burn you," his mind howled. "I didn't mean to be too late."
Her eyes stared at him, filmed, heedless of all the power in him. Lifeless. Tears trickled unheeded down his cheeks. He forced the memory away roughly. Even encased in the void, it hurt. With this much power, he could not be trusted. "You are not the creator," Moraine had told him as he stood over that child. But with that male figure, with only half of its power, he had made the mountains move once. With far less, with only Kalendor, he had been sure he could turn back the wheel, make a dead child live. Not only the one power was seductive, the power of it was, too. He should destroy them both. Instead, he rewove the flows, reset the traps.
"What are you doing there?"
a woman's voice said as the wall became apparently whole again. Tying off the flows hastily, and the knot with its own deadly surprises, he pulled the power into him and turned. Beside Lanfear, in her white and silver, Elaine or Min or Avienda would look almost ordinary. Her dark eyes alone were enough to make a man give up his soul. At the sight of her, his stomach clenched until he wanted to vomit.
"What do you want?" he demanded.
Once he had blocked Egwene and Elaine both from the true source, but he could not remember how. So long as Lanfear could touch the source, he had more chance of catching the wind in his hands than of holding her prisoner. One flash of balefire and... he could not do it. She was one of the Forsaken, but the memory of a woman's head rolling on the ground stopped him dead.
"You have two of them," she said finally. "I thought I glimpsed... one is a woman, isn't it?"
Her smile could have halted a man's heart and made him grateful.
"You are beginning to consider my plan, aren't you? With those, together, the other chosen will kneel at our feet. We can supplant the Great Lord himself, challenge the Creator. We..."
"You are always ambitious, Mirren." His voice grated in his ears. "Why do you think I turned away from you? It wasn't Ileana, whatever you like to think. You were out of my heart long before I ever met her. Ambition is all there is to you. Power is all you ever wanted. You disgust me." She stared at him, both hands pressed hard against her stomach, her dark eyes even larger than usual.
"Grendel said..."
she began faintly. Swallowing, she began again.
"Luce Theron. I love you, Luce Theron. I've always loved you, and I always will. You know that. You must."
Rand's face was like rock. He hoped it hid his shock. He had no idea where his words had come from, but it seemed he could remember her. A dim memory from before.
"I am not Luce Theron Telamon."
"I am Randall Thor," he said harshly.
"Of course you are."
Studying him, she nodded slowly to herself. That cool composure returned.
"Of course. Asmodian has been telling you things about the War of Power and me. He lies. You did love me. Until that yellow-haired trollop Ileana stole you."
For an instant, rage made her face a contorted mask. He did not think she was even aware of it.
"Did you know that Asmodian severed his own mother? What they call stilling now. Severed her and let Murdral drag her away screaming. Can you trust a man like that?"
Rand laughed aloud.
"After I caught him, you helped trap him, so he had to teach me. And now you say I cannot trust him?"
"For teaching?"
She sniffed dismissively.
"He will do that because he knows his lot is cast with you for good. Even if he managed to convince the others that he has been a prisoner, they would still tear him apart, and he knows it. The weakest dog in the pack often suffers that fate. Besides, I watch his dreams on occasion. He dreams of you triumphing over the Great Lord and putting him up beside you on high. Sometimes he dreams of me."
Her smile said those dreams were pleasant for her, but not so for Asmodian.
"But he will try to turn you against me."
"Why are you here?" he demanded.
Turn against her? No doubt she was full of the power right that moment, ready to shield him if she even suspected he meant to try anything. She had done it before, with humiliating ease.
"I like you like this, arrogant and proud. Full of your own strength."
Once she had said that she liked him unsure, that Luce Theron had been too arrogant.
"Why are you here?"
"Ravin sent the Dark Hounds after you tonight," she said calmly, folding her hands at her waist. "I would have come sooner to help you, but I cannot let the others know I am on your side yet."
On his side.
One of the Forsaken loved him, or rather, the man he had been 3,000 years ago, and all she wanted was for him to give his soul to the Shadow and rule the world with her. Or a step below her, at least.
That, and try to replace both the Dark One and the Creator.
Was she completely mad? Or could the power of those two huge Sa'angreal really be as great as she claimed? That was a direction he did not want his thoughts to take.
Why would Ravin choose now to attack me? Asmodian says he looks to his own interests, that he'll sit to one side even in the last battle, if he can, and wait for the Dark One to destroy me. Why not Samael or Demandred? Asmodian says they hate me.
Not me. They hate Luz Theron. But to the Forsaken, that was the same thing. Please, Light, I am Randall Thor.
He pushed away a sudden memory of this woman in his arms, both of them young and just learning what they could do with the power.
I am Randall Thor.
Why not Semirag, or Mogadian, or Grin?
But you are impinging on his interests now,
she laughed.
Don't you know where he is? In Andor, in Camlann itself. He rules there in all but name. Morgaze simpers and dances for him, her and half a dozen others.
Her lip curled in disgust.
He has men scouring town and countryside to find new pretties for him.
For a moment, shock held him. Elaine's mother in the hands of one of the Forsaken. Yet he dared not show concern. Lanfear had displayed her jealousy more than once. She was capable of hunting Elaine down and killing her, if she even thought he had feelings for her.
What do I feel for her?
Aside from that, one hard fact floated beyond the void, cold and cruel in its truth. He would not run off to attack Ravin, even if what Lanfear said was true.
Forgive me, Elaine, but I can't.
She might well be lying.
She would weep no tears for any of the other Forsaken he killed. They all stood in the way of her own plans. But in any event, he was done with reacting to what others did. If he reacted, they could reason out what he would do. Let them react to him, and be as surprised as Lanfear and Asmodian had been.
"Does Ravin think I'll rush to defend Morgaze?" he said. "I have seen her once in my life. The Two Rivers is part of Andor on a map, but I never saw a Queen's Guardsman there. No one has in generations. Tell a Two Rivers man Morgaze is his queen, and he'll probably think you're crazy."
"I doubt Ravin expects you to run to defend your homeland," Lanfear said wryly. "But he will expect you to defend your ambitions. He means to sit Morgaze on the Sun Throne, too, and use her like a puppet until the time he can come into the open. More Andoran soldiers move into Carrion every day. And you sent Tyran soldiers north to secure your own hold on the land. No wonder that he attacked you as soon as he found you."
Rand shook his head. It had not been that way at all, sending the Tyrans, but he did not expect her to understand. Or believe him, if he told her, for that matter.
"I thank you for the warning. Politeness to one of the Forsaken. Of course, there was nothing he could do except hope that some of what she told him was truth. A good reason not to kill her. She'll tell you more than she thinks if you listen carefully."
He hoped that was his own thought, chill and cynical as it was.
"You ward your dreams against me?"
"Against everyone." That was simple truth, though she was at least as prominent in the list as the Wise Ones.
"Dreams are mine. You and your dreams are mine especially."
Her face remained smooth, but her voice hardened.
"I can break through your warding. You would not like it."
To show his unconcern, he sat down at the foot of his pallet, legs folded and hands on his knees. He thought his face was as calm as hers. Inside him, the power swelled. He had flows of air ready to bind her and flows of spirit. That was what wove a shield against the true source. The racking of his brain for the how of it seemed far off, but he could not remember anyway. Without that, the other was useless. She could pick apart or slice through anything he wove, even if she could not see it. Asmodian was trying to teach him that trick, but it was hard going without a woman's weaving to practice on. Lanfear eyed him in a disconcerted fashion, a slight frown marring her beauty.
I have examined the Aiel women's dreams, these so-called wise ones. They do not know how to shield themselves very well. I could frighten them till they never dream again, never even think of invading yours, surely.
I thought you would not help me openly. He did not dare tell her to leave the wise ones alone. She might well do something despite him. She had made it plain from the start, if not in words, that she meant to have the upper hand between them. Wouldn't that risk another of the Forsaken finding out? You aren't the only one who knows how to enter people's dreams.
The Chosen, she said absently.
For a moment she chewed a full underlip.
I've watched the girl's dreams, too. Egwene. Once I thought you had feelings for her. Do you know who she dreams of? Morgaze's son and stepson. The son Gawain, most often.
Smiling, she put on a tone of mock shock.
You would not believe a simple country girl could have such dreams.
She was trying to test his jealousy, he realized. She really thought he warded his dreams to hide thoughts of another woman. The maidens guard me closely, he said dryly. If you want to know how close, look at Isendra's dreams. Spots of color flared in her cheeks. Of course. He was not supposed to see what she was trying. Confusion rolled outside the void. What did she think?
Isendra?
Lanfear knew she was a dark friend. Lanfear had brought Kadir and the woman to the waste in the first place. And planted most of the jewelry Isendra was accused of stealing. Lanfear's spite was cruel, even when petty. Still, if she thought he could love her, Isendra being a dark friend was probably no obstacle in her eyes. I should have let them send her off to try reaching the Dragon Wall, he went on casually. But who knows what she might have said to save herself. I must protect her and Kadir to some extent in order to protect Asmodian. The color faded, but as she opened her mouth again, a knock came at the door. Rand bounded to his feet. No one would recognize Lanfear, yet if a woman were discovered in his room, a woman whom none of the maidens below had seen enter, questions would be asked, and he had no answers. But Lanfear already had a gateway open, to somewhere full of white silk hangings and silver.
Remember that I am your only hope of surviving, my love.
It was a very cool voice in which to call someone that.
Beside me, you need fear nothing. Beside me, you can rule everything that is or will be.
Lifting her snowy skirts, she stepped through and the gateway winked shut. The knock sounded again before he could make himself push away Sidene and haul open the door. Inala peered past him, suspiciously muttering.
I thought perhaps Isendra...
She gave him an accusing look.
Spear sisters are searching everywhere for you. No one saw you return.
With a shake of her head, she straightened. She always tried to stand as tall as possible.
The chiefs have come to speak with the Kaa Karn, she said formally. They wait below.
They waited on the columned portico, as it turned out, being men. The sky was still dark, but the first glimmers of dawn lined the mountains to the east. If they felt any impatience with the two maidens who stood between them and the tall doors, it did not show on their shadowed faces.
The shadow are moving, Han barked as soon as Rand appeared. And the rain, the Miagoma, the Shianda, every clan.
Joining Culloden or me? Rand demanded.
The Shido are moving toward the Jengai Pass, Ruark said. For the others, it is too early to tell.
but they are on the march with every spear not needed to defend the holds, herds, and flocks. Rand only nodded. All of his determination not to let anyone else dictate what he would do, and now this. Whatever the other clans intended, Culloden had to plan a crossing into Cairhien. So much for his grand schemes of imposing peace, if the Shido ravaged Cairhien even further while he sat in Rhuidon, waiting for the other clans. "Then we move for the Jangai, too," he said finally.
"We cannot catch him if he means to cross,"
Aram cautioned, and Han added sourly. "If any of the others are joining him, we'll be caught strung out like blind worms in the sun." "I won't sit here until I find out," Rand said. "If I can't catch Culloden, I mean to be right behind him into Cairhien. Rouse the spears. We leave as soon after first light as you can manage." Giving him that odd Aiel bow, used only on the most formal occasions, 1 foot forward and 1 hand extended, the chiefs departed. Only Han said anything. To Shael Ghul itself.
Chapter 7. A Departure. Yawning in the early morning grayness, Egwene pulled herself up onto her fog-colored mare, then had to handle her reins smartly as mist frisked about. The animal had not been ridden in weeks. Aiel not only preferred their own legs, they avoided riding almost completely, though they did use pack horses and pack mules. Even if there had been enough wood to build wagons, the terrain in the waste was not hospitable to wheels, as more than one peddler had learned, to his or her sorrow. She was not looking forward to the long journey west. The mountains hid the sun now, but the heat would grow by the hour once it climbed clear, and there would be no convenient tent to duck into at nightfall. She was not certain that Aiel garb was suitable for riding, either. The shawl worn over her head always did a surprisingly good job of keeping the sun off, but those bulky skirts would bare her legs to the thigh if she was not careful. Blisters worried her as much as modesty. The sun on one side, and a month out of the saddle should not have softened her that much. She hoped it had not, or this would be a very long journey. Once she had settled Miss down, Egwene found Amis looking at her, and shared a smile with the wise one. All of that running the night before was not the reason she was still sleepy. If anything, it had helped her sleep even more soundly. She had found the other woman's dreams last night, and in celebration they had sipped tea in the dream, in Cold Rock's hold, early on an evening when children were playing among the crop-planted terraces, and a pleasant breeze blew down the valley as the sun sank. Of course, that would not have been enough to steal her rest, but she had been so exultant that when she left Amis's dreams she did not stop. She could not then, no matter what Amis would have said. There had been dreams all around, though with most she had no idea whose they were. With most, not all. Milane had been dreaming of suckling a babe at her breast, and Bear of one of her dead husbands, both of them young and yellow-haired. She had been especially careful not to enter those. The wise ones would have known an intruder in an instant, and she shuddered to think of what they would have done before letting her go. Rand's dreams had been a challenge, of course, one she could not fail to face. Now that she could flit from dream to dream, how could she not try where the wise ones failed? Only, attempting to enter his dreams had been like running headlong into an invisible stone wall. She knew that his dreams lay on the other side, and she was sure she could find a way through, but there'd been nothing to work on, nothing to pry at, a wall of nothing. It was a problem she meant to worry at until she solved it. Once she put her mind on something, she could be as persistent as a badger. All around her, Guy Shine were bustling about, loading the Wise One's camp onto mules. Before long, only an Aiel or someone just as skilled at tracking would be able to tell there had ever been tents on that patch of hard clay. The same activity covered the surrounding mountain slopes, and the hubbub extended into the city as well. Not everyone would be going, but thousands would. Aiel thronged the streets, and Master Kader's train of wagons stood strung out along the great plaza, laden with Moraine's selections, the three white-painted water wagons at the end of the line, like huge barrels on wheels, behind 20 mule teams. Kader's own wagon at the head of the column was a little white house on wheels, with steps at the back and a metal stovepipe sticking out of the flat roof. The thick, hawk-nosed merchant, all in ivory-colored silk today, swept off his incongruously battered hat as she rode past, his dark, tilted eyes not sharing in the wide smile he flashed at her. She ignored him frostily. His dreams had been decidedly dark and unpleasant, where they were not lewd as well. He ought to have his head dunked in a cask of blue-spine tea, she thought grimly. Approaching the roof of the maidens, she threaded her way through scurrying Guy Shine and patiently standing mules. To her surprise, one of those loading the maidens' things wore a black robe, not white. A woman by the size of her, and staggering under the weight of a cord-tied bundle on her back. Bending as she guided Mist past to get a look inside the woman's cowl, Egwene saw Isendra's haggard face, sweat already rolling down her cheeks. She was glad the maidens had stopped letting the woman go outside, or sending her out, more naked than not, but it did seem needlessly cruel to robe her in black. If she was sweating so hard already, she would nearly die once the day's heat took hold. Still, Far Darai's my business was none of hers. Avienda had told her so, gently but firmly. Adeline and Enila had been little short of rude about it, and a wiry white-haired maiden named Sulin had actually threatened to haul her back to the Wise Ones by her ear. Despite her efforts to persuade Avienda to stop addressing her as Aes Sedai, it had been irritating to find that after walking a fine line of uncertainty toward her, the rest of the maidens had come down on the side of her being just another pupil of the Wise Ones. Why, they would not even let her pass the door of the roof unless she claimed to be on an errand. The quickness with which she heeled Mist on through the crowd had nothing to do with acceptance of Far Darai's my justice, or her uncomfortable awareness that some of the maidens were eyeing her, no doubt ready to lecture if they thought she intended to interfere. It even had little to do with her dislike of Isendra. She did not want to think about her glimpse of the woman's dreams just before Coenda had come to rouse her. They had been nightmares of torture, of things being done to the woman that sent Egwene fleeing in horror, and with something dark and evil laughing as it watched her run. No wonder Isendra looked haggard. Egwene had started up out of her sleep so quickly that Coenda had jumped back from laying a hand on her shoulder. Rand was in the street in front of the maiden's roof, wearing a shufa against the coming sun, and a blue silk coat with enough gold embroidery to befit a palace, though it hung open halfway down the front. His belt had a new buckle, an elaborate thing shaped like a dragon. He really was beginning to think a great deal of himself. That was clear. Standing beside Giadaan, his dappled stallion, he was talking with the clan chiefs and some of the Aiel traders who would be staying in Roydion. Jacin Natael, nearly at Rand's heels, with his harp on his back, and holding the reins of a saddled mule bought from Master Kader, was even more elaborately dressed, with silver embroidery nearly hiding his black coat and spills of white lace at his neck and cuffs. Even his boots were worked in silver where they turned down at the knee. The gleeman's cloak with its patches did spoil the effect, but gleemen were odd folk. The male traders wore the Cadin sore, and though their belt knives were smaller than those of warriors, Egwene knew they could all handle a spear if called to. They had something, if not all, of the deadly grace of their brothers who carried the spear. The women traders in loose white algoda blouses and full woolen skirts, headscarves and shawls were more easily distinguishable. Except for maidens and Guy Shine and Avienda, Aiel women all wore multiple bracelets and necklaces of gold and ivory, silver and gemstones, some of Aiel make, some traded for, and some looted. Among Aiel traders, though, the women displayed twice as many, if not more. She caught part of what Rand was telling the traders. Give the Ogier stonemasons a free hand on some of what they build, at least. On as much as you can make yourselves. There's no point in just trying to remake the past. So he was having them send to the Steading for Ogier to rebuild Roydion. That was good. Much of Tar Valon was Ogier work, and where they were left to their own devices, their buildings were enough to take the breath away. Matt was already up on his gelding pips, with his wide-brimmed hat pulled down and the butt of that odd spear resting on his stirrup. As usual, his high-collared green coat looked slept in. She had avoided his dreams. One of the maidens, a very tall, golden-haired woman, gave Matt a roguish grin that seemed to embarrass him. And well it should. She was much too old for him. Egwene sniffed. I know very well what he was dreaming about, thank you very much. She only reined in beside him to look around for Avienda. He told her to be quiet, and she did, he said as she halted mist. He nodded toward Moiraine and Lan, she in pale blue silk, gripping the reins of her white mare, and he in his warder's cloak, holding his great black warhorse. Lan was watching Moiraine intently, expressionless as always, while she looked ready to burst with impatience as she glared at Rand. She started telling him why this is the wrong thing to do. Sounded to me like she was saying it for the 100th time, and he said, I've decided, Moiraine, stand over there and be quiet till I have time for you. Like he expected her to do as she was told. And she did. Is that steam coming out of her ears? His chortle was so pleased, so amused at his own wit, that she nearly embraced Sidar and taught him a lesson right there in front of everybody. Instead, she sniffed again, loudly enough to let him know it was for him and his wit and his amusement. He gave her a wry, sidelong look and chuckled again, which did nothing for her temper. For a moment she stared at Moiraine, perplexed. The Aes Sedai had done as Rand told her? Without protest? That was like one of the wise ones obeying, or the sun rising at midnight. She had heard about the attack, of course. Rumors about giant dogs that left footprints on stone had been all over this morning. She could not see what that could have to do with this, but aside from the news of the Shido, it was the only new thing she knew of, and not enough to produce this reaction. Nothing could produce it that she could think of. Doubtless Moiraine would tell her it was none of her concern, but one way or another she would worry it out. She did not like not understanding things. Spotting Avienda, standing on the bottom step of the roof, she guided Mist around to the other side of the crowd near Rand. The Aiel woman was staring at him as hard as the Aes Sedai did, but with absolutely no expression. She kept turning the ivory bracelet on her wrist over and over, apparently without realizing it. Somehow or other, that bracelet was part of the difficulty the woman was having with him. Egwene did not understand. Avienda refused to talk about it, and she could not just ask someone else, not when it might embarrass her friend. Her own flame-carved ivory bracelet was a gift from Avienda, to seal them as near sisters. Her return gift had been the silver necklace the other woman wore, which Master Kader claimed was a Kandori pattern called Snowflakes. She'd had to ask Moiraine for enough money, but it had seemed appropriate for a woman who would never see snow. Or would not have, if she was not leaving the waste. Small chance that she could return before winter. Whatever that bracelet meant, Egwene was confident she could puzzle it out eventually. "Are you all right?" she asked. As she leaned out of her high-cantled saddle, her skirts shifted till her legs showed, but she was concerned enough with her friend to hardly notice. She had to repeat the question before Avienda gave a start and stared up at her. "All right? Of course I am. Let me speak to the wise ones, Avienda. I'm sure I can convince them that they cannot just make you—" She could not make herself say it, not out here where anyone in the crowd might hear. "Does that still worry you?" Avienda shifted her gray shawl and gave a small shake of her head. "Your customs are still very strange to me." Her eyes drifted back to Rand, like iron filings drawn to a lodestone. You do not have to be afraid of him. I am not afraid of any man, the other woman snapped, eyes flashing blue-green fire. I want no trouble between us, Egwene, but you should not say such things. Egwene sighed. Friend or not, Avienda was quite capable of trying to box her ears when offended enough. In any case, she was not sure she would have admitted it either. Avienda's dream had been too painful to watch for long. Naked but for that ivory bracelet and that seeming to drag at her as if it weighed 100 pounds, Avienda had been running as hard as she could across a cracked clay flat. And behind her, Rand came, a giant twice the size of an ogier, on a huge geoden, slowly but inexorably catching up. But you could not simply tell a friend that she was lying. Egwene's face reddened slightly, especially not when you would have to tell her how you knew. She would box my ears then. I won't do it again, go rummaging about in people's dreams. Not in Avienda's dreams, anyway. It was not right to spy on a friend's dreams. Not that it was spying exactly, but still. The crowd around Rand was beginning to break up. He swung into his saddle easily, imitated promptly by Natael. One of the traders, a broad-faced, flame-haired woman wearing a small fortune in worked gold, cut gems, and carved ivory, lingered, though. Karakarn, do you mean to leave the threefold land forever? You have spoken as if you will never return. The others stopped at that and turned back. Silence spread on an expanding ripple of murmurs telling what had been asked. For a moment Rand was silent as well, looking around at the faces turned to him. At last he said, I hope to return, but who can say what will happen? The wheel weaves as the wheel wills. He hesitated with every eye on him. But I will leave you something to remember me by, he added, sticking a hand in his coat pocket. Abruptly a fountain near the roof burst to life, water gushing from the mouths of incongruous porpoises standing on their tails. Beyond that, a statue of a young man with a horn raised to the sky suddenly was putting up a spreading fan, and then two stone women farther on were casting sprays of water from their hands. In stunned stillness, the Aiel watched as all the fountains of Roydion flowed once more. I should have done that long since. Rand's mutter was no doubt meant for himself, but in the hush Egwene could hear him quite clearly. The splash of hundreds of fountains was the only other sound. Natael shrugged, as if he had expected no less. It was at Rand that Egwene stared, not the fountains. A man who could channel. Rand. He still ran, despite everything. But each time she saw him do it was like learning that he could all over again. Growing up, she had been taught that only the Dark One was more to be feared than a man who could channel. Maybe Avienda's right to be afraid of him. But when she looked down at Avienda, open wonder shone on her face. So much water delighted the Aiel woman, as the finest silk dress might have Egwene, or a garden full of flowers. It is time to march, Rand announced, reining the dapple westward. Anyone who isn't ready will have to catch up. Natael followed close behind on the mule. Why did Rand let such a bootlicker stay near him? The clan chiefs immediately began passing orders, and the bustle increased tenfold. Maidens and water-seekers darted ahead, and more far Darais Mai closed around Rand as a guard of honor, incidentally enclosing Natael. Avienda strode beside Geoden, right at Rand's stirrup, easily matching the stallion stride for stride even in her bulky skirts. Falling in beside Matt, behind Rand and his escort, Egwene frowned. Her friend wore that look of grim determination again, as if she had to put her arm into a viper den. I have to do something to help her. Egwene did not give up on a problem once she had her teeth into it. Settling herself in her saddle, Moiraine patted Aldib's arched neck with a gloved hand, but she did not immediately follow Rand. Hadnan Kader was bringing his wagons up the street, driving the lead wagon himself. She should have made him tear that wagon down to carry cargo as she had the other like it. The man was frightened enough of her, of Aes Sedai, to have done it. The door-frame Turangrial was lashed firmly in the wagon behind Kader, canvas tied over it tightly, so no one could fall through by accident again. A long line of Aiel, Sayadun, Black Eyes, strode along on either side of the wagon train. Kader bowed to her from the driver's seat, but her gaze swept on down the line of wagons, all the way to the great square surrounding the forest of slim glass columns, already sparkling in the morning light. She would have taken everything in the plaza if she could, rather than the small fraction that would fit into the wagons. Some were too large, like the three dull gray metal rings, each more than 2 paces across, standing on edge and joined at the middle. A braided leather rope had been strung around that one, to warn all from entering without the Wise One's permission. Not that anyone was likely to, of course. Only the clan chiefs and the Wise Ones entered that square with any sense of ease. Only the Wise Ones touched anything, and they with something approaching proper reticence. For countless years, the second test faced by an Aiel woman who wanted to be a Wise One had been to enter the array of glittering glass columns, seeing exactly what the men saw. More women survived it than men. Bear said it was because women were tougher. Amis that those too weak to survive were winnowed out before reaching that point, but it was not a certainty. Those who did survive were not marked. The Wise Ones claimed that only men needed visible signs. For a woman, to be alive was enough. The first test, the first winnowing before any training even, was to step through one of those three rings. Which one did not matter, or perhaps the choice was a matter of fate. That step seemingly took her through her life again and again, her future spread out before her, all of the possible futures based on every decision she might make for the rest of her life. Death was possible in those, too. Some women could not face the future any more than others could face the past. All possible futures were too many for a mind to retain, of course. They jumbled together and faded away for the most part, but a woman gained a sense of things that would happen in her life, that must happen, that might happen. Usually even that was hidden until the moment was on her. Not always, though. Moiraine had been through those rings. A spoonful of hope and a cup of despair, she thought.
I do not like seeing you like this, Lan said.
From Mandarb's back and his own height, he looked down on her, disquiet creasing the corners of his eyes. For him, that was near tears of frustration from another man. Aiel streamed by on both sides of their horses, and Gaishine with pack animals. Moiraine was startled to realize that Kader's water wagons had already gone by. She had not realized she had been staring at the plaza for so long. "Like what?" she asked, turning her mare to join the throng. Rand and his escort were already out of the city. "Worried," he said bluntly. No readable expression on that stone-carved face now. Afraid. I've never seen you afraid. Not when we had Trollocs and Murdral swarming over us. Not even when you learned the Forsaken were loose and Samael was sitting almost on top of us. Is the end coming?
She gave a start, and immediately wished she had not. He was looking straight ahead over his stallion's ears, but the man never missed anything. Sometimes she thought he could see a leaf fall behind his back.
"Do you mean Tarman Gaiden? A red bird in Silaisin knows as well as I. The light send, not so long as any of the seals remain unbroken." The pair she had were on one of Kader's wagons, too, each packed by itself in a cask stuffed with wool. A different wagon than the redstone doorframe, she had made sure of that.
"What else could I mean?"
he asked slowly, still not looking at her and making her wish she had bitten her tongue.
"You have become impatient. I can remember when you could wait weeks for one tiny scrap of information, one word, without twitching a finger. But now..."
He did look at her then, a blue-eyed gaze that would have intimidated most women, and most men as well.
"The oath you gave to the boy, Moiraine. Whatever under the light possessed you."
He has been drawing further and further away from me, Lan, and I must be close to him. He needs whatever guidance I can give, and I will do everything short of sharing his bed to see that he gets it. The rings had told her that that would be a disaster. Not that she had ever considered it. The very idea still shocked her, but in the rings it was something she would or could have considered in the future. It was a measure of her growing desperation, no doubt, and in the rings she had seen that it would bring ruination on everything. She wished she could remember how. There were the keys to Randall Thor in anything she could learn about him, but only the simple fact of calamity remained in her mind. "Perhaps it will help your humility grow if he tells you to fetch his slippers and light his pipe." She stared at him. Could that be a joke? If so, it was not amusing. She had never found that humility served very well in any situation. Swan claimed that growing up in the Sun Palace in Kyrian had put arrogance deeply into Moiraine's bones, where she could not even see it, something she firmly denied. But for all that Swan was a Tyran fisherman's daughter, she could match any queen stare for stare, and to her, arrogance meant opposition to her own plans. If Lan was attempting jokes, however feeble and wrong-headed, he was changing. For nearly 20 years he had followed her and saved her life more times than she cared to count, often at great risk to his own. Always he had accounted his life a small thing, valuable only for her need of it. Some said he wooed death the way a bridegroom wooed his bride. She had never held his heart, and never felt jealousy toward the women who seemed to throw themselves at his feet. He had long claimed that he had no heart, but he had found one this past year, found it when a woman tied it on a string to hang around her neck. He denied her, of course. Not his love for Nynaeve Almira, once a wisdom in the Two Rivers and now an accepted of the White Tower, but that he could ever have her. He had two things, he said, a sword that would not break and a war that could not end. He would never gift a bride with those. That, at least, Moiraine had taken care of, though he would not know how until it was done. If he did, he would very probably try to change matters, stubborn fool man that he could be. This arid land seems to have withered your own humility, Al Lan Mandragoran. I shall have to find some water to make it grow again. My humility is honed to razor sharpness, he told her dryly. You never let it grow too dull. Wetting a white scarf from his leather water bottle, he handed her the sodden cloth. She tied it around her temples without comment. The sun was beginning to rise above the mountains behind them, a searing ball of molten gold. The thick columns snaked up the barren side of Cheyendare, its tail still in Rhydion when its head had crested the slope, then down onto rough hilly flats dotted with rock spires and flat-topped buttes, some streaked with red or ochre through the gray or brown. The air was so clear that Moiraine could see for miles, even after they were down off Cheyendare. Great natural arches reared, and in every direction jagged mountains clawed at the sky. Dry gullies and hollows split a land sparsely dotted with low thorny bushes and leafless spiny plants. The rare tree, gnarled and stunted, usually bore spines or thorns as well. The sun made it an oven, a hard land that had shaped a hard people. But Lan was not the only one changing, or being changed. She wished she could see what Rand would make of the Aiel in the end. There was a long journey ahead for everyone. Chapter 8. Over the Border. Clinging to her perch at the rear of the jouncing wagon, Nynaeve used one hand for herself and one for her straw hat as she peered back at the furious dust storm dwindling behind them in the distance. The broad brim shaded her face in the morning heat, but the breeze generated by the wagon's rumbling speed was enough to snatch it from her head, despite the dark red scarf tied under her chin. Low-hilled grassland with occasional thickets rolled by, the grass sere and thin in the late summer heat. Dust churned up by the wagon wheels obscured her vision somewhat, and made her cough besides. The white clouds in the sky lied. There had been no rain since before they left Tanchico, weeks earlier, and it had been some time since the wide road had borne the traffic of wagons that once kept it hard-packed. No one appeared riding out of that seemingly solid wall of brown, which was just as well. She had lost her anger at brigands trying to stop them this close to escaping the madness of Terrebon, and unless she was angry, she could not sense the true source, much less channel. Even angry, she had been surprised at being able to raise such a storm. Once whipped up, full of her fury, it held a life of its own. Elaine had been startled at the size of it, too, though thankfully she had not let on to Tom or Julin. But even if her strength was increasing, her teachers in the tower had said that it would, and certainly none of them was strong enough to best one of the Forsaken as she had. Even with that, she still had that limitation. Had any of the bandits appeared, Elaine would have had to deal with them alone, and she did not want that. Her earlier anger was gone, but she was making fine for another crop. Awkwardly climbing up over the canvas lashed across the load of casks, she reached down to one of the water barrels fastened along the sides of the wagon together with the chests of their possessions and supplies. Immediately her hat was on the back of her head, held only by the scarf. Her fingers could just touch the lid of the barrel, unless she released the rope that she was gripping with her other hand, and the way the wagon was lurching along, that would probably send her off onto her nose. Julin Sandar guided the lanky brown gelding he was riding. Skulker was the improbable name he had put on the animal, close to the wagon, and reached over to hand her one of the leather water bottles slung about his saddle. She drank gratefully, though not gracefully. Hanging there like a bunch of grapes on a wind-blown vine, she spilled nearly as much water down the front of her good gray dress as she did down her throat. It was a suitable dress for a merchant, high-necked, finely woven and well-cut, but still plain. The pin on her breast, a small circle of dark garnets in gold, was perhaps too much for a merchant, but it had been a gift from the Panarch of Terrebon, along with other jewelry, much richer, hidden in a compartment beneath the wagon driver's seat. She wore it to remind herself that even women who sat on thrones sometimes needed to be taken by the scruff of the neck and shaken. She had a little more sympathy for the tower's manipulations of kings and queens now that she had dealt with Amathera. She suspected that Amathera had meant her gifts as a bribe to make them depart Tanchico. The woman had been willing to buy a ship so that they would not remain an hour more than necessary, but no one had been willing to sell. The few vessels remaining in Tanchico Harbor that were suitable for more than coasting had been jammed with refugees. Besides, a ship was the obvious way, the fastest way, to leave, and the Black Aja might well be watching for her and Elaine after what had happened. They had been sent to hunt Aes Sedai, who were dark friends, not to be ambushed by them. Thus the wagon and the long trek across a land torn by civil war and anarchy. She was beginning to wish she had not insisted on avoiding the ships. Not that she would ever admit it to the others. When she tried to hand the water bottle back to Julin, he waved it away. A tough man, seemingly carved from some dark wood, he was not very comfortable on the back of a horse. He looked ridiculous to her, not because of his obvious ill-ease in the saddle, but for the silly red Tarabonner hat that he had taken to wearing on his flat black hair. A brimless, conical thing, tall and flat-topped. It did not go well with his dark Tyran coat, tight to the waist, then flaring. She did not think it would go well with anything. In her opinion, he looked as if he were wearing a cake on his head. It was clumsy, scrabbling the rest of the way forward with the leather bottle in one hand and her hat flapping, and she did it, muttering imprecations for the Tyran thief-catcher. Never thief-taker, not him. For Tom Merrillan, puffed-up glee man. And for Elaine of House Trakand, daughter-heir of Andor, who ought to be shaken by the scruff of the neck herself. She meant to slide onto the wooden driver's seat between Tom and Elaine, but the golden-haired girl was pressed tightly against Tom, her own straw hat hanging on her back. She was clutching the white-mustached old fool's arm as if afraid of falling off. Tight-mouthed, Nynaeve had to settle for Elaine's other side. She was glad she had her hair in one proper braid again, wrist thick and hanging down to her waist. She could give it a tug instead of thumping Elaine's ear for her. The girl had used to seem reasonably sensible, but something seemed to have addled her wits in Tanchico. "They aren't following us any more," Nynaeve announced, pulling her hat back into place. "You can slow this thing down now, Tom." She could have shouted that from the back, and not needed to clamber over the casks, but the image of herself bouncing about and calling for them to slow had stopped her. She did not like making a fool of herself, and liked even less others seeing her in a foolish light. "Put your hat on," she told Elaine. "That fair skin of yours will not appreciate this sun for long." As she had half expected, the girl ignored her friendly advice. "You drive so wonderfully," Elaine gushed as Tom drew back on the reins, pulling the four-horse team to a walk. "You were in control every minute." The tall, wiry man glanced down at her, bushy white eyebrows twitching, but all he said was, "We have more company ahead, child." Well, maybe he was not such a fool. Nynaeve looked and saw the snowy-cloaked mounted column approaching them over the next low rise, perhaps 50 men in burnished mail and shining conical helmets, escorting as many heavily laden wagons. Children of the Light. She was suddenly very conscious of the leather thong hanging around her neck beneath her dress, and the two rings dangling between her breasts. Lan's heavy gold signet ring, the ring of the kings of Lost Malkyr, would mean nothing to the white cloaks, but if they saw the great serpent ring... Fool woman. They aren't likely to unless you decide to undress. Hastily she ran an eye over her companions. Elaine could not stop being beautiful, and now that she had let go of Tom and was retying the green scarf that held her hat, her manner looked more suited to a throne room than a merchant's wagon, but aside from being blue, her dress was no different from Nynaeve's. She wore no jewelry. She had called Amathera's gifts gaudy. She would pass. She had done so 50 times since Tanchico. Barely. Only, this was the first meeting with white cloaks. Tom, in stout brown wool, could have been any of 1,000 gnarled white-haired men who worked wagons. And Julin was Julin. He knew how to behave, though he looked as though he wished he were sure-footed on the ground, with his staff or the slotted sword-breaker he wore at his belt, rather than on a horse. Tom drew the team over to one side of the road and halted as several white cloaks broke away from the head of the column. Nynaeve put on a welcoming smile. She hoped they had not decided that they needed another wagon. "The light illumine you, Captain," she said to the narrow-faced man who was obviously the leader, the only one not carrying a steel-tipped lance. She had no idea what rank the two golden knots signified on the breast of his cloak, right below the flaring sunburst they all wore, but in her experience men would accept any flattery. "We are very glad to see you. Bandits tried to rob us a few miles back, but a dust storm appeared like a miracle. We barely You are a merchant? Few merchants have come out of Terrabon in some time." The man's voice was as harsh as his face, and that looked as though all joy had been boiled out of it before he left the cradle. Suspicion filled his dark, deep-set eyes. Nynaeve did not doubt that was permanent, too. "Bound to where? With what?" "I carry dyes, Captain." She worked to maintain her smile under that steady, unblinking stare. It was a relief when he shifted it to the others briefly. Tom was making a good job of appearing bored, just a wagon driver who would be paid stopped or moving. And if Julin had not snatched off that ridiculous hat as he once would have, at least he seemed no more than idly interested, a hired man with nothing to hide. When the white cloak's gaze dropped to Elaine, Nynaeve felt the other woman stiffen and hurried on. "Terrabonner dies. The finest in the world. I can get a good price for them in Andor." At a signal from the captain, or whatever he was, one of the other white cloaks heeled his horse to the back of the wagon. Slicing one of the ropes with his dagger, he jerked some of the canvas loose, enough to expose 3 or 4 casks. "They're branded Tanchico, Lieutenant. This one says Crimson.
Do you want me to break open a few?
Nynaeve hoped the white cloak officer took the anxiety on her face the right way. Even without looking at her, she could all but feel Elaine wanting to call the soldier down for his manners, but any real merchant would be worried at having dyes exposed to the elements. If you will show me the ones you want opened, Captain, I will be more than happy to do it myself. The man showed no response at all to flattery or offers of cooperation. The casks were sealed to keep out dust and water, you see. If the cask head is broken, I'll never be able to cover it over with wax again here. The rest of the column reached them and began to pass in a cloud of dust. The wagon drivers were roughly dressed, nondescript men, but the soldiers rode stiffly erect, their long steel lance points all slanted at exactly the same angle. Even sweaty-faced and coated with dust, they looked hard men. Only the drivers glanced at Nynaeve and the others. The white-cloaked lieutenant waved dust away from his face with one gauntleted hand, then motioned the man back from the wagon. His eyes never left Nynaeve. "You come from Tanchico." Nynaeve nodded, a picture of cooperation and openness. "Yes, Captain. Tanchico."
"What word have you of the city? There have been rumors."
"Rumors, Captain? When we left, there was little order remaining. The city was full of refugees, and the countryside of rebels and bandits. Trade hardly exists." That was the truth, pure and simple. "That's why these dyes will fetch particularly good prices. There will be no more Tarabonner dyes available for a long while, I think."
"I do not care about refugees, trade, or dyes, merchant," the officer said in flat tones. "Was Andric still on the throne?"
"Yes, Captain."
"Obviously, rumor said someone had taken Tanchico and supplanted the king, and perhaps someone had. But who? One of the rebel lords who fought each other as hard as they did Andric? Or the dragon sworn who had pledged themselves to the dragon reborn without ever seeing him?"
"Andric was still king and Amathera still panarch when we left."
His eyes said she could be lying. "It is said the Tarvalen witches were involved. Did you see any Aes Sedai or hear of them?"
"No, Captain," she said quickly. The great serpent ring seemed hot against her skin. 50 white cloaks, close at hand. A dust storm would not help this time. And anyway, though she tried to deny it, she was more scared than angry. "Plain merchants don't mingle with that sort." He nodded, and she risked adding a question, anything to change the subject. "If you please, Captain, have we entered Amadicia yet?"
"The border is 5 miles east," he pronounced. "For the time being. The first village you come to will be Mardisan. Obey the law and you will be well. There is a garrison of the children there."
He sounded as if the garrison would spend all of its time making sure they did obey the law. "Have you come to move the border?" Elaine asked suddenly and coolly. Nynaeve could have strangled her. The deep-set, suspicious eyes shifted to Elaine, and Nynaeve said hastily, "Forgive her, my lord captain. My eldest sister's girl. She thinks she should have been born a lady, and she can't keep away from the boys besides. That's why her mother sent her to me." Elaine's indignant gasp was perfect. It was also probably quite real. Nynaeve supposed she had not needed to add that about boys, but it seemed to fit. The white cloak stared at them a moment longer, then said, "The Lord Captain Commander sends food into Tarabon. Otherwise we would have Tarabonner vermin over the border and stealing anything they could chew. Walk in the light," he added, before swinging his horse to gallop back to the head of the column. It was neither suggestion nor blessing. Tom got the wagon moving as soon as the officer left, but everyone sat silent, except for coughing, until they were well beyond the last soldier and out of the other wagon's dust. Swallowing a little water to wet her throat, Nynaeve pushed the water bottle at Elaine. "What did you mean back there?" she demanded. "We aren't in your mother's throne room, and your mother would not stand for it anyway." Elaine emptied the rest of the leather bottle before deigning to reply. "You were crawling, Nynaeve."
She pitched her voice high in a mock servility.
I am very good and obedient, Captain. May I kiss your boots, Captain?
We're supposed to be merchants, not queens in disguise. Merchants do not have to be lickspittles. You are lucky he didn't think we were trying to hide something, acting so servile. They don't stare down their noses at white cloaks with 50 lances, either. Or did you think we could overwhelm them all with the power if need be? Why did you tell him I could not keep away from boys? There was no need for that, Nynaeve. I was ready to tell him anything that would make him go away and leave us alone, and you...
Both of you, shut up!
Tom barked suddenly, before they come back to see which of you is murdering the other. Nynaeve actually twisted around on the wooden seat to look back before she realized the white cloaks were too far off to hear, even if they had been shouting. Well, maybe they had been. It did not help that Elaine did the same. Nynaeve took a firm hold on her braid and glared at Tom, but Elaine snuggled herself against his arm and practically cooed. You are right, Tom. I am sorry I raised my voice. Julin was watching them sideways, pretending not to, but he was wise enough not to bring his horse close enough to become part of it. Letting go of her braid before she pulled it out by the roots, Nynaeve adjusted her hat and sat staring straight ahead over the horses. Whatever had gotten into the girl, it was high time to get it out again. Only a tall stone pillar to each side of the road marked the border between Tarabon and Amanicia. There was no traffic on the road but them. The hills gradually became a little higher, but otherwise the land remained much the same, brown grass and thickets with few green leaves except on pine or leather leaf or other evergreens. Stone-fenced fields and thatch-roofed stone farmhouses dotted the slopes and dells, but they had a look of abandonment. No smoke rising from chimneys, no men working crops, no sheep or cows. Sometimes a few chickens scratched in a farmyard near the road, but they scurried away, gone feral, at the wagon's approach. White cloak garrison or no, apparently no one was willing to risk Tarabon or brigands this close to the border. When Mardisan appeared from the top of a rise, the sun still had a long way to climb to its zenith. The town ahead looked too big for the name of village, nearly a mile across, straddling a small bridged stream between two hills, with as many slate roofs as thatched, and considerable bustle in the wide streets. "We need to buy supplies," Nynaeve said, "but we want to be quick about it. We can cover a lot of ground yet before nightfall."
"We are wearing out, Nynaeve," Tom said. "First light to last light every day for nearly a month. One day resting will not make much difference in reaching Tar Valon."
He did not sound tired. More likely he was looking forward to playing his harp or his flute in one of the taverns and getting men to buy him wine. Julin had finally brought his mount close to the wagon, and he added,
"I could do with a day on my feet. I do not know whether this saddle or that wagon seat is worse."
"I think we should find an inn," Elaine said, looking up at Tom. "I have had quite enough of sleeping under this wagon, and I would like to listen to you tell stories in the common room."
"One wagon merchants are little more than peddlers," Nynaeve said sharply. "They cannot afford inns in a town like this."
She did not know whether that was true or not, but despite her own desire for a bath and clean sheets, she was not going to let the girl get away with directing the suggestion at Tom. It was not until the words were out of her mouth that she realized that she had given in to Tom and Julin.
"One day won't hurt. It's a long way to Tar Valon yet."
She wished she had insisted on a ship. With a fast ship, a seafolk raker, they could have gotten to Tyr in a third of what it had taken them to cross Tarabon, as long as they had good winds, and with the right Athaan Mier windfinder that would have been no problem. She or Elaine could have handled it, for that matter. The Tyrans knew that she and Elaine were friends of Rand's, and she expected that they still sweated buckets for fear of offending the Dragon Reborn. They would have provided a carriage and escort for the journey up to Tar Valon.
"Find us a place to camp," she said reluctantly. She should have insisted on a ship. They might have been back in the tower by now.
Chapter Chapter 9. A Signal. Nynaeve had to admit that Tom and Julin between them had chosen a good campsite in a sparse thicket growing on an eastern slope, covered with dead leaves a scant mile from Mardison. Scattered sour gums and some sort of small, droopy-branched willow screened the wagon from the road and the town, and a 2-foot-wide rivulet ran from a stone outcrop near the top of the rise down a bed of dried mud twice as broad. Enough water for their purposes. It was even a little cooler under the trees, with a small and welcome breeze. Once the two men had watered the team and hobbled them where the horses could feed on the sparse grass upslope, they tossed a coin to decide which should take the lanky gelding into Mardison to purchase what they needed. The coin flipping was a ritual that they had developed. Tom, whose nimble fingers were used to performing sleight of hand, never lost when he flipped the coin, so Julin always did it now. Tom won anyway, and while he was stripping the saddle from Skulker, Nynaeve put her head under the wagon seat and levered up a floorboard with her belt knife. Besides 2 small gilded coffers containing Amathera's presents of jewelry, several leather purses bulging with coin lay in the recess. The Panarch had been more than generous in her desire to see their backs. The other things looked trifling by comparison. A small dark wooden box, polished but plain and uncarved, and a wash-leather purse lying flat and showing the impression of a disc inside. The box held the 2 Turangrial they had recovered from the Black Adja, both linked to dreams, and the purse, that was their prize from Tanchico, one of the seals on the Dark One's prison. As much as she wanted to find out where Swan Sanche wanted them to chase the Black Adja next, the seal was the source of her haste to reach Tar Valon. Digging coins from one of the fat purses, she avoided touching the flat purse. The longer it remained in her possession, the more she wanted to hand it to the Amarlin and be done with it. Sometimes she thought she could feel the Dark One trying to break through when she was near the thing. She saw Tom off with a pocketful of silver and a strong admonition to search out some fruit and green vegetables. Either man was likely as not to buy nothing but meat and beans, left to himself. Tom's limp as he led the horse off toward the road made her grimace. An old injury, and nothing to be done for it now, so Moiraine said. That rankled as much as the limp itself. Nothing to be done. When she had left the 2 rivers, it had been to protect young people from her village, snatched away in the night by an Aes Sedai. She had gone to the tower still with the hope that she could somehow shelter them, and the added ambition of bringing down Moiraine for what she had done. The world had changed since then, or maybe she only saw the world differently. No, it is not me that's changed. I'm the same. It is everything else that's different. Now it was all she could do to protect herself. Rand was what he was, and no turning back. And Egwene eagerly went her own way, not letting anyone or anything hold her back, even if her way led over a cliff. And Matt had learned to think of nothing but women, carousing, and gambling. She even found herself sympathizing with Moiraine sometimes, to her disgust. At least Perrin had gone back home, or so she had heard through Egwene, second-hand from Rand. Perhaps Perrin was safe. Hunting the Black Adja was good and right and satisfying, and also terrifying, though she tried to hide that part. She was a grown woman, not a girl who needed to hide in her mother's apron. Yet that was not the main reason she was willing to keep on bashing her head against a wall, keep on trying to learn to use the power, when most of the time she could not channel any more than Tom. That reason was the talent, called healing. As wisdom of Emmons Field, it had been gratifying to bring the women's circle around to her way of thinking, especially since most were old enough to be her mother. With not many years on Elaine, she had been the youngest wisdom ever in the 2 rivers. And even more so to see that the village council did what they should, stubborn men that they were. The most satisfaction, though, had always come from finding the right combination of herbs to cure an illness. To heal with the one power. She had done it, fumbling, curing what her other skills never could. The joy of it was enough to bring tears. One day she meant to heal Tom and watch him dance. One day she would even heal that wound in Rand's side. Surely there was nothing that could not be healed, not if the woman wielding the power was determined enough. When she turned from watching Tom go, she found that Elaine had filled the bucket that normally hung beneath the wagon and was kneeling to wash her hands and face, a towel around her shoulders to keep her dress dry. That was something she particularly wanted to do herself. In this heat, it was pleasant sometimes to wash in water cool from a stream. Often enough there had been no water but what was in the barrels strapped to the wagon, and that was needed for drinking and cooking more than washing. Julin was sitting with his back against one of the wagon wheels, his thumb-thick staff of pale ridged wood leaning next to him. His head was down, that silly hat tipped precariously over his eyes, but she was not willing to bet on even a man sleeping at this time of the morning. There were things he and Tom did not know, things it was best they did not know. The thick carpet of dead sour gum leaves crackled as she seated herself near Elaine. "Do you think Tanchico really has fallen?" Rubbing a soapy cloth slowly across her face, the other woman did not reply. She tried again. "I think that white cloak's Aes Sedai were us." "Perhaps." Elaine's voice was cool, a pronouncement from the throne. Her eyes were blue ice. She did not look at Nynaeve. "And perhaps reports of what we did got tangled with other rumors. Tarabon could have a new king and a new panarch very easily." Nynaeve kept her temper in check and her hands away from her braid. They clutched her knees instead. "You are trying to put her at ease with you. Watch your tongue." "Amethera was difficult, but I do not wish her any harm. Do you?" "A pretty woman," Julin said, "especially in one of those Tara Bonner serving girls' dresses, with a pretty smile. I thought she..." He saw Elaine and her looking at him, and quickly pulled his hat back down, pretending to sleep again. She and Elaine shared a glance, and she knew the other's thought was the same as hers. Men. "Whatever has happened to Amethera, Nynaeve, she is behind us now." Elaine sounded more normal. Her washcloth slowed. "I wish her well, but mainly I hope the Black Aja is not behind us. Not following, I mean." Julin stirred uneasily without raising his head. He was still uncomfortable with the knowledge that Black Aes Sedai were real and not simply a tale in the streets. "He should be happy he doesn't have our knowledge." Nynaeve had to admit that the thought was not entirely logical, but if he had known about the Forsaken being loose, even Rand's foolish instruction to look after her and Elaine would not have kept him from running. Still, he was useful at times, he and Tom both. It had been Moiraine who had fastened Tom to them, and the man knew a great deal about the world for an ordinary gleeman. "If they were following, they'd have caught up by now." That was surely true, considering the usual lumbering speed of the wagon. "With any luck, they still do not know who we are." Elaine nodded, grim but her old self again, and began rinsing her face. She could be almost as determined as a Two Rivers woman. "Leandrin and most of her cronies surely escaped from Tanchico, maybe all of them. And we still don't know who is giving orders for the Black Aja in the tower. As Rand would say, we still have it to do, Nynaeve." Despite herself, Nynaeve winced. True, they had a list of 11 names, but once they were back in the tower, almost any Aes Sedai they spoke to might be Black Aja, or any women they encountered on the road. For that matter, anyone they met might be a dark friend, but that was hardly the same thing, not by a wide degree. "More than the Black Aja," Elaine continued. "I worry about Mo..." Nynaeve put a quick hand on her arm and nodded slightly toward Julin. Elaine coughed and went on as though that was what had stopped her. "About Mother. She has no reason to like you, Nynaeve. Quite the opposite." "She's far away from here." Nynaeve was glad her voice was steady. They were not talking about Elaine's mother, but the Forsaken she had defeated. Part of her hoped fervently that Mogadine was far away, very far. But if she was not? She is, Nynaeve said firmly, but she still hitched her shoulders uncomfortably. A part of her remembered humiliations suffered at Mogadine's hands, and desired nothing more than to face the woman again, to defeat her again, for good this time. Only, what if Mogadine took her by surprise, came at her when she was not angry enough to channel? The same was true of any of the Forsaken, of course, or of any Black Sister for that matter. But after her rout in Tanchico, Mogadine had reason to hate her personally. Not pleasant at all to think that one of the Forsaken knew your name and likely wanted your head. That is just rank cowardice, she told herself sharply. You are not a coward, and you will not be. That did not stop the itch between her shoulder blades every time Mogadine came to mind, as if the woman was staring at her back. I suppose looking over my shoulder for bandits has made me nervous, Elaine said casually, patting her face with the towel. Why, sometimes when I dream of late, I have the feeling that someone is watching me. Nynaeve gave a start at what seemed an echo of her own thoughts, but then she realized there had been a slight emphasis on dream. Not any dreams, but Tel Iron Riod, another thing the men did not know about. She had had the same sensation, but then there was often a feel of unseen eyes in the world of dreams. It could be uncomfortable, but they had discussed the sensation before. She made her voice light. Well, your mother is not in our dreams, Elaine, or she would probably snatch us both up by an ear. Mogadine would probably torture them until they begged for death, or arrange a circle of 13 Black Sisters and 13 Murdral. They could turn you to the shadow against your will that way, bind you to the Dark One. Maybe Mogadine could even do it by herself. Don't be ridiculous, woman. If she could have, she would have. You beat her, remember? I do hope not, the other woman replied soberly. Do you mean to give me a chance to wash? Nynaeve asked irritably. Putting the girl at ease was all very well, but she could do with less talk of Mogadine. The Forsaken had to be somewhere distant. She would not have let them come this far peacefully if she knew where they were. Light send that that's true. Elaine emptied and refilled the bucket herself. She was a very nice girl, usually, when she remembered that she was not in the royal palace in Caenlyn, and when she was not acting the fool. That Nynaeve would take care of when Tom came back. Once Nynaeve had enjoyed a slow, cooling wash of face and hands, she set about making the camp ready, and put Julin to breaking dead branches from the trees for a fire. By the time Tom returned with two wicker hampers slung across the gelding's back, her and Elaine's blankets were laid out under the wagon, and the two men's under the hanging branches of one of the 20-foot willows. A good supply of firewood had been stacked. The tea kettle stood cooling beside the ashes of a fire in a circle cleared of leaves, and the thick pottery cups had been washed. Julin was grumbling to himself as he caught water in the tiny stream to refill the water barrels. From the snatches Nynaeve heard, she was glad he kept most of it to an inaudible mutter. From her perch on one of the wagon shafts, Elaine hardly tried to hide her interested attempt to make out what he was saying. Both she and Nynaeve had put on clean dresses on the other side of the wagon, switching colors as it happened. After fastening hobbles between the gelding's forelegs, Tom lifted the heavy hampers down easily and began unpacking them.
Mar Deason's not as prosperous as it looks from a distance.
He set a net bag of small apples on the ground and another of some dark green leafy vegetable.
With no trade into Tarabon, the town is withering.
The rest seemed to be all sacks of dried beans and turnips, plus pepper-cured beef and salt-cured hams, and a gray pottery bottle sealed with wax that Nynaeve was sure held brandy. Both men had complained of not having a bit of something with their pipes of an evening.
You can hardly take six steps without seeing a white cloak or two. The garrison is about 50 men or so, with barracks over the hill from the town on the far side of the bridge. It was considerably larger, but it seems Padrone Niall is pulling white cloaks from everywhere into Amador.
Knuckling his long mustaches, he looked thoughtful for a moment.
I cannot see what he is up to.
Tom was not a man who liked that. Usually a few hours in a place was enough for him to begin ferreting out the currents between noble and merchant houses, the alliances and schemes and counterplots that made up the so-called game of houses. The rumors are all about Niall trying to stop a war between Ilion and Altara, or maybe Ilion and Mirandi. No reason there for him to be gathering in soldiers. I'll tell you one thing, though. Whatever that lieutenant said, it is a king's tax that buys the food being sent into Tarabon, and the people are not happy with it. Not to feed Taraboners.
King Aelron and the Lord Captain Commander are not our concern, Nynaeve said, studying what he had brought. 3 salted hams. We will pass through Amadicia as quickly and unobtrusively as we can. Perhaps Elaine and I will have more luck finding vegetables than you did. Would you care for a walk, Elaine?
Elaine got up immediately, smoothing her gray skirts and lifting her hat from the wagon.
That would be very nice, after that wagon seat. It might be different if Tom and Julin let me take a turn riding Skulker more often.
For once she did not give the old glee man a coquettish look, which was something. Tom and Julin exchanged glances, and the tyrant thief-catcher pulled a coin from his coat pocket, but Nynaeve gave him no chance to flip it.
We will be quite all right by ourselves. We could hardly expect trouble of any sort with so many white cloaks to keep order.
Planting her hat on her head, she tied the scarf under her chin and gave them a firm look.
Besides, all those things Tom bought need to be put away.
Both men nodded, slowly, reluctantly, but they did it. Sometimes they took their roles as supposed protectors entirely too seriously. She and Elaine had reached the empty road and were walking down the verge, on the thin grass, so as not to kick up dust, before she had it settled in her mind how to bring up what she wanted to say. Before she could speak, though, Elaine said,
"You obviously want to talk to me alone, Nynaeve. Is it about Mogadine?"
Nynaeve blinked and looked at the other woman sideways. It was well to remember that Elaine was no fool. She'd only been acting like one. Nynaeve resolved to keep a tight hold on her temper. This was going to be difficult enough without letting it dissolve into a shouting match.
"Not that, Elaine."
The girl thought they should add Mogadine to their hunt. She could not seem to realize the difference between one of the Forsaken and, say, Leandrin or Chesmal.
"I thought we should discuss how you've been behaving toward Tom."
"I do not know what you mean," Elaine said, staring straight ahead toward the town, but sudden spots of color in her cheeks gave her the lie.
"Not only is he old enough to be your father twice over, but he is not my father," Elaine snapped. "My father was Tarangale de Modred, a prince of Cairhien and first prince of the Sword of Andor."
Straightening her hat needlessly, she went on in a milder tone, though not by much.
"I am sorry, Nynaeve. I did not mean to shout."
"Temper," Nynaeve reminded herself.
"I thought you were in love with Rand," she said, making her voice gentle. "It was not easy.
The messages you have me give to Egwene for him certainly say so. I expect you tell her the same."
The color in the other woman's face heightened.
"I do love him, but he is very far away, Nynaeve. In the waste, surrounded by 1,000 maidens of the spear who jump to do his bidding. I cannot see him or speak to him or touch him."
She was whispering by the end.
"You can't think he'll turn to a maiden," Nynaeve said incredulously. "He is a man, but he isn't as fickle as that. And besides, one of them would put a spear in him if he looked at her crossways, even if he is this Dawn whatever. Anyway, Egwene says Avienda is keeping an eye on him for you."
"I know, but I should have made sure that he knew I love him."
Elaine's voice was determined and worried.
"I should have told him so."
Nynaeve had hardly looked at a man before Lan, at least not seriously, but she had seen and learned much as wisdom. From her observations, there was no quicker way to send a man running for his life, unless he said it first.
"I think Min had a viewing," Elaine went on, "about me and about Rand. She always used to joke about having to share him, but I think it wasn't a joke, and she could not bring herself to say what it really was."
"That is ridiculous." It certainly was. Though, in Tyr, Avienda had told her of a vile Aiel custom.
"You share land with Moiraine," a small voice whispered.
"That isn't the same thing at all," she told it briskly.
"Are you certain Min had one of her visions?"
"Yes. I wasn't at first, but the more I think on it, the more sure I become. She joked about it too often to mean anything else."
"Well, whatever Min had seen, Rand was no Aiel. Oh, his blood might be Aiel, as the wise ones claimed, but he had grown up in the Two Rivers, and she would not stand by and let him take up wicked Aiel ways. She doubted very much that Elaine would, either.
Is that why you've been,"
she would not say, "throwing yourself at, teasing Tom?"
Elaine gave her a sidelong glance, the crimson back in her cheeks.
"There are 1,000 leagues between us, Nynaeve. Do you think Rand is refraining from looking at other women? A man is a man, on a throne or in a pigsty."
She had a stock of homely sayings from her childhood nurse, a clear-headed woman named Lini, whom Nynaeve wished she would meet one day.
"Well, I don't see why you have to flirt just because you think Rand might."
She refrained from bringing up Tom's age again.
"Lan is old enough to be your father," that small voice murmured.
"I love Lan. If I can only reason out how to get him free of Moiraine, that is not the matter at hand."
"Tom is a man with secrets, Elaine. Remember that Moiraine sent him with us. Whatever he is no simple country gleeman."
"He was a great man," Elaine said softly. "He could have been greater, except for love."
With that, Nynaeve's temper snapped. She rounded on the other woman, seizing her by the shoulders.
"The man doesn't know whether to turn you over his knee or climb a tree."
"I know," Elaine gave a frustrated sigh, "but I do not know what else to do."
Nynaeve ground her teeth in the effort not to shake her until her skull rattled. "If your mother heard of this, she'd send Lini to haul you back to the nursery."
"I am not a child any longer, Nynaeve."
Elaine's voice was strained, and now the flush in her cheeks was not embarrassment.
"I am as much a woman as my mother is."
Nynaeve stalked on toward Mardison, gripping her braid so hard that her knuckles hurt. After a few strides, Elaine caught up.
"Are we really going to buy vegetables?"
Her face was composed, her tone light.
"Did you see what Tom brought back?" Nynaeve said tightly.
Elaine shuddered elaborately.
3 hams, and that awful peppered beef. Do men ever eat anything but meat if it isn't set before them?"
Nynaeve's temper faded as they walked on, talking about the foibles of the weaker sex, men, of course, and such simple matters as that. Not completely away, of course. She liked Elaine and enjoyed her company. At times it seemed as if the girl really was Egwene's sister, as they sometimes called each other, when Elaine was not acting the twitch skirt. Tom could put a stop to it, of course, but the old fool indulged Elaine like a fond father with his favorite daughter, even when he did not know whether to say boo or faint. One way or another she meant to get to the bottom of it, not for Rand's sake, but because Elaine was better than this. It was as if she had contracted a strange fever. Nynaeve intended to cure it. Granite slabs paved the streets of Mardison, worn by generations of feet and wagon wheels, and the buildings were all brick or stone. A number of them were empty, though, both shops and houses, sometimes with the front door standing open, so Nynaeve could see the bare interior. She saw 3 blacksmith's shops, 2 abandoned, and in the third the smith was half-heartedly rubbing his tools with oil, and the forges were cold. One slate-roofed inn, with men sitting morosely on benches out front, had a number of broken windows, and at another the adjoining stable had its doors half off the hinges, and a dusty coach squatting in the stable yard, one forlorn hen nesting on the driver's high seat. Somebody in that one was playing the bittern, Heron on the Wing, it sounded like, but the tune was dispirited. The door of a third inn was barred by two splintery planks nailed across it. People thronged the streets, but they moved lethargically, weighted down by the heat. Dull faces said they had no real reason to stir at all beyond habit. Many women, in large, deep bonnets that almost hid their faces, had on dresses worn at the hem, and more than one man had a frayed collar or cuffs on his knee-length coat. There were indeed white cloaks scattered through the streets, if not so many as Tom had made out, still enough. Nynaeve's breath caught every time she saw a man in a pristine cloak and shining armor look at her. She knew she had not worked with the power nearly long enough to take on Aes Sedai agelessness, but those men might well try to kill her, a Tarvalan witch, and outlawed in Amadicia, if they even suspected a connection to the White Tower. They strode through the crowds, seemingly oblivious of the apparent poverty around them. People moved out of their way respectfully, receiving perhaps a nod, if that, and often a sternly pious, "Walk in the light." Ignoring the children of the light as best she could, she set herself to finding fresh vegetables, but by the time the sun reached its peak, a blazing ball of gold that burned through the thin clouds, she and Elaine had wandered both sides of the low bridge, and between them had managed to garner one small bunch of honey peas, some tiny radishes, a few hard pears, and a basket to carry them in. Perhaps Tom really had looked. This time of year the barrows and stalls should have been full of the summer's produce, but most of what they saw was heaped potatoes and turnips that had known better days. Thinking of all those empty farms approaching the town, Nynaeve wondered how these people were going to make it through the winter. She walked on. Hanging upside down beside the door of a thatch-roofed seamstress's shop was a bunch of what looked almost like broomweed, with tiny yellow flowers, the stalks wrapped their whole length in a white ribbon, then tied with a dangling yellow one. It might have been some woman's feeble attempt at a festive decoration in the midst of hard times, but she was sure it was not. Stopping beside an empty shop with a carving knife incised on the sign still hanging over the door, she pretended to search for a stone in her shoe while furtively studying the seamstress's shop. The door was open, and colorful bolts of cloth stood in the small paned windows, but no one went in or out.
"Can you not find it, Nynaeve? Take off your shoe."
Nynaeve's head jerked. She'd almost forgotten that Elaine was there. No one else was paying any attention to them, and no one looked close enough to overhear. She still lowered her voice. "That bunch of broomweed by that shop door. It is a yellow Aja signal, an emergency signal, from one of the yellow's eyes and ears." She did not have to tell Elaine not to stare. The girl's eyes barely moved toward the shop.
"Are you certain?"
she asked quietly.
"And how do you know?"
"Of course I am certain. It's exact. The hanging bit of yellow ribbon is even split in three." She paused to take a deep breath. Unless she was completely mistaken, that insignificant fistful of weeds held a dire meaning. If she was wrong, she was making a fool of herself, and she did hate to do that. "I spent a good deal of time talking with yellows in the tower. Healing was the main purpose of the yellows. They did not care much for her herbs, but you did not need herbs when you could heal with the power. One of them told me. She did not think it too great a transgression, since she was sure I'll choose yellow. Besides, it has not been used in nearly 300 years. Elaine, only a few women in each Aja actually know who the Aja's eyes and ears are,
but a bunch of yellow flowers tied and hung like that tells any yellow sister that here one is, and with a message urgent enough to risk uncovering herself. How are we going to find out what it is? Nynaeve liked that. Not, what are we going to do? The girl had backbone. Follow my lead, she said, gripping the basket tighter as she straightened. She hoped she remembered everything Shimmerin had told her. She hoped Shimmerin had told her everything. The plump yellow could be fluttery for an Aes Sedai. The interior of the shop was not large, and every scrap of wall was taken up by shelves holding bolts of silk or finely woven wool, spools of piping and binding, and ribbons and lace of every width and description. Dressmakers' dummies stood about the floor wearing garments ranging from half-made to complete, from something suitable for a dance in embroidered green wool to a pearly gray silk gown that could have done very well at court. At first glance, the shop had a look of prosperity and activity, but Nynaeve's sharp eye caught a hint of dust in one high neck of frothy solind lace, and on a large black velvet bow